me.
The new series of Your Mum, including maternal memories from Catherine Ryan, Hugh Dennis, Nish Kumar, and more.
Mi madre es Miss Honey.
Tomorrow night from 11. To listen on your smart speaker, just say Play Radio 4.
On 92 to 95 FM and on BBC Sounds, this is BBC Radio 4. Good morning. It's 6 o'clock on Friday, the 4th of September. This is Today with Nick Robinson in Birmingham and Anna Foster in Salford.
Good morning from the Reform Party conference, where the party is facing fresh questions about the money it accepts from wealthy donors.
Can we just order food?
Yeah.
Oysters, please. Like? Should we do four each?
I'll have half a dozen.
That's amazing.
Cheers. Cheers.
Undercover filming of that oyster and champagne lunch broadcast by Channel 4 appears to show a senior aide to the Reform leader, Nigel Farage, trying to get around electoral law to secure a foreign donation of £500,000. The party denies any wrongdoing. We'll be speaking to their deputy leader, Richard Tice, at 8:10, and we'll also hear from the former head of the Electoral Commission, which enforces party funding laws. Our other main headline today, Argentina has raised tensions with the UK over the Falkland Islands, warning it will impose economic sanctions on British and Israeli oil firms in the area.
Across the world, winds of change favourable to our claim are blowing. President Trump said recently the US is re-evaluating its historical position regarding Las Malvinas. This path is not in vain.
Also in today's programme, several schools near Middlesbrough will close early today in anticipation of disruption caused by the funeral of one of the young men killed in the A66 crash. We'll speak to one local MP who says the area needs more help from Westminster. Why has the number of formal complaints about new build homes tripled just in the last year? And the legendary British animation studio behind Wallace and Gromit turns 50. Always a jolly way to start the day. We'll speak to one of the founders of Aardman Animations. Before all of that, the BBC News is read for us this morning by James Steele.
Argentina's President Javier Milei has heightened tensions with the UK over the Falkland Islands, warning that he will impose economic sanctions on companies which exploit oil close to the British Overseas Territory. Mr. Milei made his televised address after being emboldened by Donald Trump's suggestion that he might reconsider the American stance on the Falklands. A British task force pushed out Argentina's military when it invaded the islands in the 1982 war. Mr. Milei insisted any production by a British-Israeli venture at the Sea Lion oil field around 130 miles from the Falklands represented a clear danger. Our correspondent Will Grant reports.
President Milei announced his sanctions plan surrounded by his cabinet at the presidential palace. The Falklands are Argentine, he said. However, the crux was a plan to introduce a bill to Parliament to impose sanctions on energy firms planning to begin oil exploration off the Falklands. Today, our national cause faces a clear and urgent danger and demands a proportional response, he said. Two oil companies, one Israeli and one British, are due to begin exploration work in the Sea Lion oil field off the Falklands coast within 2 years. Something Mr. Milei said Argentina could not allow. The UK government has always insisted the Falkland Islanders are British, with a right to determine their own future.
Undercover filming by Channel 4 appears to show a senior aide to Nigel Farage suggesting a way to get around electoral law to try to secure a foreign donation of £500,000 for Reform UK. The party denies any wrongdoing. Our political correspondent Harry Farley reports from Reform UK's conference in Birmingham.
The adviser, Dan Jukes, is filmed meeting a man posing as the British-based son of a rich American. Under electoral law, only those registered to vote here or companies registered here are permissible donors to political parties. The undercover reporter tells Mr. Jukes of his concern that because of this, his father wouldn't be able to directly donate to Reform. Mr. Jukes appears to suggest the donation should be made by the son, although the funds would have been made available to him from his father. The undercover filming was done by a group called Verbatim Investigations, which was founded by journalists from the Centre for Climate Reporting. A Reform UK spokesperson said it had launched an investigation, but said the party had been the target of a hoax perpetuated by foreign-funded climate change activists. Dan Jukes has been approached for comment.
BBC News understands that the government will approve a new gas field off the coast of Aberdeen as soon as this month. The Jackdaw project was first approved by the Conservative government in 2022, but environmental groups successfully challenged the decision in the courts, arguing that officials had not given enough consideration to the impact of burning fossil fuels. Here's our business editor, Simon Jack.
Jackdaw could provide up to 6% of the UK's gas supplies at full production, according to its owners, Adura. The UK relies on imports from Norway and the US for more than half its gas needs. A consultation on a new application for Jackdaw closed in August, and the BBC understands that approval may come as soon as mid-September. The environmental campaign group Uplift said Jackdaw's true contribution to UK gas supplies would be closer to 2% and would do nothing to cut energy bills. The Department for Energy, Security and Net Zero said it did not comment on speculation.
Emergency teams in Nepal have recovered two survivors from a hydropower tunnel. The rescues come more than a week after a massive flash flood devastated the border area between Nepal and Tibet. Officials say they expect at least 39 people to be rescued from the tunnel. Our South Asia correspondent Azadeh Mashiri reports from one of the worst affected areas, the district of Rasuwa.
Amid all the devastation, this is a moment of hope. Rescuers suddenly heard voices in the Trishuli 3A tunnel more than a week after the flood that has devastated border areas. Rescuers made their way through flooded tunnels choked with mud and debris. The crew had previously blasted a hole in the crown of the tunnel and had descended on ropes. Excavators have also been used and oxygen is being pumped in. The survivors are now being airlifted to army hospitals for treatment, and the hope is more will follow.
The army has been told to stop large non-essential training exercises to save money. The government is increasing defence spending to 2.5% of national income by next year, and pressure is building to reach 3% by the end of the decade. Our defence correspondent Jonathan Beale reports.
Those British Army units not on operations have been told to halt plans for large training exercises because of the financial pressures facing the MOD. An army spokesperson said instead it would prioritise activity that contributed most directly to readiness and operational effectiveness. The army says it's investing £2 billion to transform training by learning the lessons from the war in Ukraine. But the pause in other training will only highlight the MOD's continuing struggle to make ends meet and the growing pressure on the government to further increase defence spending.
The US Vice President J.D. Vance has said the fighting between America and Iran is not a war and has avoided specifying when it might end. Speaking to reporters, Mr. Vance said the US had ended major combat operations despite renewed attacks by both sides this week. The Environment Secretary has suggested people should stock up on food ahead of a government campaign about preparing for future national emergencies. Dame Angela Eagle said that events such as El Niño, the weather pattern which can increase the risk of droughts and floods around the world, needed to be taken seriously. Here's our political correspondent, Jack Fenwick.
Dame Angela Eagle, the new Environment Secretary, will oversee the building of the country's first new reservoir since 1992, as well as changes to farming, which ministers hope will make the UK more adaptable to a changing climate. She said the naturally occurring El Niño weather phenomenon could lead to drier summers, wetter winters and more extreme storms in the UK. In the coming months, the Cabinet Office will launch a campaign on preparing for emergencies. Dame Angela told The Guardian newspaper that households would be a lot better off if they stocked up on things like canned food and urged people to take steps to ensure they were more resilient.
Jack Fenwick reporting.
Thank you, Jane. It's coming up to 9 minutes past six. Sarah Keith Lucas can tell us what the weather's got in store for us this morning. Morning, Sarah.
Good morning to you, Nick. We've got quite a breezy day ahead out there with some rain around at times, but it will be turning brighter and fresher as we head through into the afternoon. For southern England, lots of places starting off dry. We will see the cloud increasing and outbreaks of rain moving south across the region, but the rain will be fizzling out as it does so. It is a warm start here, though. Temperatures around 20 degrees in a few spots already. It'll get up to about 23 here by the afternoon. For Wales, the Midlands and eastern England, heavy rain at the moment, which should clear south over the next few hours. So sunny spells developing, 20 or 21 degrees here. Northern England, Northern Ireland and Scotland. Plenty of heavy showers around first thing. For most places, they're going to ease away, but they'll continue across the northwest of Scotland, where they could be frequent and heavy and thundery at times as well. It's also going to be pretty windy, gusts 40 or 50 miles an hour in the far north. Temperatures here in the north around 16 to 20 degrees today.
Thank you very much indeed, Helen. It is 6:09. Let's take a first look at the morning papers. The main story for the Times is the army halting some training exercises to save money. The paper quotes the director of the National Army Museum as saying that it shows a national dereliction of duty. The Daily Mail suggests that the army is missing in action. The Daily Express carries a warning from the Tory leader, Kemi Badenoch, that we must act now on defence spending before it's too late. Noting that Argentina is now claiming a sacred right to the Falkland Islands, the Sun asks what chance would Britain have of defending them now?
The Environment Secretary Dame Angela Eagle tells The Guardian that British people should stockpile enough food and water to survive for a few days because of the threat of extreme weather. She says we're about to experience probably the largest El Nino that has ever been seen, in reference to the climate pattern that results in drier summers, wetter winters and more violent storms. The Telegraph carries a wider warning from the National Audit Office saying Britain should prepare for food shortages caused by extreme weather events, by cyber attacks and disease outbreaks.
Daily Mail leads with concerns raised by the head of the Metropolitan Police, Sir Mark Rowley, that violent criminals are being freed on bail to commit murder because of the prison overcrowding crisis. The paper says Sir Mark told the London Policing Board that he was flabbergasted and expected to see a rise in violent crime as a result.
The Daily Mirror considers the case of a man kept alive for 9 months by a pig's kidney. It says the procedure offers hope for thousands on the transplant list, but quotes the chief medical officer for NHS Blood and Transport as cautioning that even if shown to be effective, there's still a very long way to go before these transplants could become an everyday reality. The transplant, according to The Sun, saved the patient's bacon.
And a number of the papers let their art critics loose on the Bayeux Tapestry. Jonathan Jones in The Guardian gives it 5 stars, says it's a stupefying, tragicomic epic depicting the madness of war, describing it as a spine-shivering tapestry triumph. Laura Freeman also gives it 5 stars in The Times. She suggests that if the film director, Sir Christopher Nolan, is looking for a post-Odyssey project, he could try Hastings. It also gets 5 stars from The Telegraph as well, where Alistair Sook says the sheer scale of the masterpiece is deeply moving.
And it got 5 stars from all of us lucky enough to be there yesterday. It's now 6:12.
It did. Well worth listening back, by the way, if you missed that. Now that is the sound of a dramatic moment in Nepal. 2 workers being rescued from a hydro power tunnel there 9 days after the flash flood that has killed so far more than 1,200 people, but many more are still missing. Stephen McDonnell, our correspondent, is following developments from Beijing. Stephen, these moments of hope keeping rescuers going. Tell us what happened.
I mean, can you imagine what a morale boost this is for the emergency teams in Nepal? They thought that on the 10th day of this emergency, they couldn't possibly really find anyone alive. And yet, they've dragged these 2 emergency workers out of a collapsed hydropower tunnel. It's just absolutely remarkable. I mean, what had happened earlier on is that they'd entered this tunnel, rappelling down with ropes, apparently, and they've used equipment to sort of blast open larger sections of the tunnel. And they're pumping air in there and also cameras. But in the end, it was just the old school sticking the head down the tunnel and calling out, is anyone down there? And they got 2 voices back. And they said, look, just be patient. We're going to get you out. And then soon army teams were entering. They've not only located those 2 surviving workers, but now brought them out of the tunnel. And they're already on their way to hospital as we speak. What's more, officials have told the BBC in Nepal that they think they might find others there today. There's great hope that others could have survived, because when this original wall of water and mud came through, which has been likened to an inland tsunami. It's thought that maybe hundreds of hydropower workers were caught underground and that they could use various bits and sections of the tunnel system to hide from it. And so that's why they've been concentrating on working there to try and reach people. And in the end, it's paid off.
And Stephen, as you say, those moments, I mean, just to imagine what it must have been like to be in one of those tunnels for all that time. And I wonder whether anybody is coming to rescue you. But more broadly, it's more a recovery operation really elsewhere, isn't it?
Yes, beyond rescuing these men in the tunnels, in other areas where if you're out in the open or somewhere like that, where you might have been in a building that collapsed or something along those lines, yeah, it would take an absolute miracle to find anyone else alive on either the Tibet or Nepalese side of the border, given that the power of that wave that came through. But like I said, the tunnels, it's a difference. Obviously, it's a unique situation there where they possibly also had access to some water and maybe even something small to eat or something along those lines. And, I mean, imagine you've got to survive 10 days. You can't do that unless you've got water. So there must have been a way that they've been able to survive, and we'll no doubt hear about that.
Yeah, I'm sure we will. It's an extraordinary story, isn't it? Thank you, Stephen. Stephen McDonnell, our correspondent in Beijing.
Quarter past six now. Today sees the funeral of one of the young men killed in a crash that left two police officers dead on Teesside. Tensions are so high that four schools are closing early. Our correspondent in Middlesbrough, Jessica Lane, joins us. Morning to you, Jessica. Closing early, pretty extraordinary measure. What have they said about that?
Yeah, morning, Nick. It is quite unusual, isn't it? But head teachers at these four local schools, they're in the South Bank area, so just to the east of Middlesbrough. They have warned parents that large crowds are expected to gather in the area for the funeral this afternoon. Police have said the same. Cleveland police say they are expecting large crowds. Also that traffic will be disrupted and delayed from about 3 o'clock this afternoon until about 5 o'clock because of the funeral. Now, police are saying that they are working closely with local authorities to try and minimise that disruption, and also that they have got plans in place to make sure that everyone is safe, as they would do with any large gathering. But as you say, it has raised some concerns. So the Shadow Education Secretary, Laura Trott, has called on Lucy Powell, the Education Secretary, to make sure that schools can remain open. She says she's worried about children potentially missing out on school time. And she's also said that schools need to have sufficient police support to make sure they can stay safe. The BBC has contacted the Department for Education about this. And of course, this is going to continue to be something that is talked about over the next week or so, as the funerals for the other four young men who were in the car take place. And then also next week, there are the funerals for the two police officers, PC Matthew Blades and PC Tom Clough. And those are expected to be large, sort of full police ceremonial funerals. So the decision apparently to close the schools early, we hear, has come after discussions between head teachers and also the council. And Redcar and Cleveland Borough Council say that they know that an early closure may well cause disruption to some families if, you know, parents are working or if they had plans today. But they have said as well that the schools wanted to make sure that the teachers and the children would be able to leave safely at the end of the school day. But of course, this all comes after the vigil that was held last week ended with several cars being set on fire.
Jessica Lane in Middlesbrough, thank you.
17 minutes past six now. As you were hearing in the news there, government approval for the Jackdaw gas field project could come as soon as mid-September, the BBC understands. Felicity Hannah's here with more on that and the rest of the morning's business news as well. Hello, Felicity.
Hello, yes. So the operator of the gas field, Agera, says if approval comes in September, then Jackdaw could be ready to deliver gas to UK homes by this winter, saying that construction is 99% complete. The Jackdaw project was first approved by the Conservative government in 2022. It was then successfully challenged in court by environment groups, arguing that officials hadn't given enough consideration to the impact of burning fossil fuels. There's been a public consultation on the future of Jackdaw and on another new oil field, Rosebank. That closed in August. The decision now rests with the Energy Secretary, Miatta Fambula. Let's talk to Chris O'Shea, who's the Chief Executive of Centrica, which has businesses in gas supply, trading, storage, production, and of course also owns British Gas. Chris, good morning.
Good morning, Felicity. How are you doing?
You actually worked at BG Group, didn't you, when it had an interest in Jackdaw? So what's your view on this? Would approval be important for the UK's energy security?
Yeah, I did. I worked at BG Group when this was discovered over 20 years ago. Look, the UK imports over 50% of its gas, so any addition to domestic gas will reduce our reliance on imported fossil fuels. So it's got to be good.
Reduce reliance, but we should be clear. It wouldn't cut bills. It wouldn't reduce prices for households. Those prices are set internationally, so UK gas fields don't lower the cost for consumers.
So it wouldn't lower the cost materially, but basic economics would tell you that if you've got a fixed demand for a product and you increase the supply, the price should move. But it wouldn't be a material movement in price in the UK. But remember that the government taxes North Sea oil and gas production at 78%. So whilst it may not move the UK consumer bills materially, it does give the government a lot of revenue, and it's up to the government to choose what it does with that revenue.
Ajura says that it could provide 6% of the UK's energy supply at its peak. Environmental groups like Greenpeace, like Uplift, they say it's more like 2%. Is this a significant environmental cost with a fairly minor outcome at best for our energy security?
So look, I think that we get into a discussion about whether burning fossil fuels is the right thing, and I think we all want to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels. But to the extent you have to burn fossil fuels, then it's cleaner to the gas that you produce domestically in the UK is cleaner than the gas that you import with LNG. Now, we own the UK and Europe's largest LNG terminal, and so we have a lot of LNG that comes in through the Grain LNG terminal. But when you produce that gas in the US or in Africa or Australia, whatever it is, you incur carbon emissions to turn that gas into liquid. And then you incur carbon emissions when you transport that gas on a ship, and then you incur carbon emissions when you effectively heat the gas back up to turn it back into a gas. So whilst when you burn the gas, ultimately it's the same carbon emissions, there are more carbon emissions associated with imported gas. But ultimately, whatever we do with gas, it's got to be on a transition to getting off fossil fuels over the next several decades.
Let's talk about gas storage, which is an area where Centrica has a direct interest. The front page of the Financial Times this morning is warning that Europe faces winter with the lowest ever gas reserves because of the conflict that we've seen in the Gulf. How about the UK? How's the UK set?
So the UK has capacity to store less than 10% of the gas that our friends in Europe has. So France, Germany, the Netherlands, they can each store around 100 days. The UK has capacity to store 12 days of average, or around 9 days of peak winter demand. Rough, the gas storage facility that we own in the North Sea, provides half of that UK gas storage. And in Rough, we haven't injected any gas into storage for that over the summer, because the summer prices have been at the same level as the winter prices, or even higher. And the way the model used to work is you would buy it in the summer when it was cheaper, you would put the gas into storage, you would take it out in the winter, and that would cover your operating costs and hopefully give you a bit of a profit. But the gas price split between winter and summer now has disappeared, or has actually inverted. So the UK has very limited gas in storage. Europe also has the lowest levels of gas in storage for at least 13, 14 years. So we are quite exposed. Now, the question is, will we see supply difficulties over the winter? And I'm not sure, but given that we import over 50% of our gas, people talk about getting off the roller coaster of international fossil fuel prices, which sometimes sounds a bit like hyperbole to me. But if you do want to get off that roller coaster, it makes more sense to have gas in storage. And if we had Rough full of gas, it's guaranteed that the price would be lower for consumers over the winter.
So what do you need to get Rough full of gas?
So the UK, so Rough is like a big battery. So we should ignore whether we use gas to heat homes. Gas is what we use to produce power when the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine. And during the winter, there's definitely less sun in the UK, and often there's less wind. And so we need gas to generate electricity. And the UK has chosen what they call a cap and floor method, which basically your returns are capped. So there's a floor in your return, so there's a minimum return you can make. There's a cap on your return, and that's guaranteed through regulation. That's the UK's chosen structure for long-duration energy storage. And all we're asking for is Rough to be included within that existing framework.
So you want government support then to allow you to store more gas in Rough?
Well, we want the government the government's chosen framework to provide gas to provide energy security through long duration energy storage to simply be extended to Rough. We don't want any government money. We stand ready to invest £2 billion, create several thousand jobs in the UK during the construction phase and safeguard several hundred jobs. We've got amazing colleagues on the Rough platform and in the Easington Gas Terminal. Mm. And this is a key strategic asset for the UK.
But Rough made a £57 million operating profit in the first half of the year. Why on earth do you need state support then to use it, to fill it?
Yeah, that was very much unexpected. The reason that we made the profit was simply that we're taking out gas that we, indigenous gas effectively. Rough was originally a gas production field. And as we, what they call blow it down, as we take the remaining gas out, in order to be responsible operators, we sell that gas. So we made a profit on that gas. Had that gas been injected as storage and then withdrawn the same quantity of gas, we would have made a loss. So the profit that we made in the first half was very much unexpected, but it's not sustainable.
A spokesperson for the government's Department for Energy Security and Net Zero told us gas storage capacity was only 5% of supply last winter. It says they remain open to discussing proposals on all gas storage sites as long as it provides value for money for taxpayers. You're asking for the government to set a floor so you don't lose money, but that means Centrica could make big profits.
No, because you put a cap on it as well. And, you know, Rough could deliver 10%, around 10% of the UK's peak gas demand in the winter. And the government's right, we have had discussions, but we've been discussing this for 10 years. I've been doing this job 6.5 years. I've been 7 energy secretaries, 6 chancellors and 5 prime ministers. And there comes a point where we've got to have a decision. So we've been discussing this with officials at the Department for Energy Security and Net Zero for several years. The government's own electricity system operator has noted the need for gas storage. The government's own interim response in the consultation for gas, which was published 6 months after the response closed, noted that the market is not supporting gas storage and there might be a need for regulation. However, all we're asking is the government at the moment provides a cap and floor mechanism for the interconnectors which connect us to import gas and electricity from both Europe. And all we're asking for is that same framework. Some of those interconnectors are owned by UK companies, some are owned by overseas companies. So we're asking for nothing new. We're simply asking for the government to implement its own policy on Rough.
National Gas, which is responsible for the management, the transmission of gas in the UK, it told us it's got no concerns about current storage levels. And we are a lot less dependent on storage than countries like Germany, for example, for supply through winter. I mean, is Rough a solution to a problem that doesn't exist? Are you perhaps arguably using fears over energy security to lobby for a commercial benefit?
Well, no, Rough is an insurance policy. And, you know, I think it's quite something for National Gas to say that they're not concerned. And it's something that I would fundamentally disagree with. Now, remember, we own a large LNG terminal. So Centrica makes more money if the UK imports a lot of gas because it comes through the terminal that we own in Kent. And so this is not Centrica looking to maximise its own profits. This is looking to say that if you want resilience, you need to have gas in storage. And we do think it's probably going to be a warmer winter because of this El Nino phenomenon that seems to be building and will probably last until February. So I can't guarantee that you need gas in storage. But if you think about it from a point of view of consumer bills, and National Gas, I don't think, are thinking about this from a point of view of consumer bills, then we commissioned an independent study to show what would have happened had Rough been open during the start of the Russia invasion of Ukraine, and it would have saved household bills £100 per year over a two-year period. Well, that's substantial.
Hindsight is always very helpful, isn't it? I want to just briefly touch
basic
on the
economics rather than hindsight.
Okay, let's talk briefly about the escalation around the Falkland Islands from the Argentine president. Now, I know Centrica's not involved in those oil projects, but I'm curious as to whether you think that could increase pressure on global energy markets.
Look, I don't know enough about what's going on in the Falkland Islands, and we don't explore for oil and gas. But again, I'd go back to a point I made earlier on, which is if you have a fixed demand for any product, if you increase the supply, the price goes down. If you reduce the supply, the price goes up. So anything which restricts product onto the market is not good for consumers.
Chris O'Shea, Chief Executive of Centrica. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you. Well, those energy bills we've been talking about will push up prices for households and businesses, of course, and that pushes up inflation. Now, the Bank of England's chief economist, Hugh Pill, has said interest rates should be raised to tackle threats to inflation sparked by the Middle East energy shock. Anna McDonald is investment strategy director at Hargreaves Lansdown, joins me now. Anna, Hugh Pill says he's uncomfortable with the wait-and-see approach of fellow policymakers. What will those policymakers be considering when it comes to interest rates?
Well, I think the key issue for the Bank of England, as with other central banks, is whether those higher energy prices become embedded into the wider economy through what they call second round effect. So that's if high energy costs feed into wage demands or broader price setting. And so that's what he's concerned about. And it's worth remembering he was one of the two MPC members who voted for a rate rise in the last decision.
People might listen to this and think, hang on, if my bills are going up, the last thing I also need is my mortgage or my rent rising as well.
Yes, and we've seen that broadly reflected from company announcements too. For example, yesterday Crest Nicholson had a profit warning just talking about the wider pressures still facing the housing market. And we know that house builders are particularly sensitive to consumer confidence and mortgage affordability.
Anna McDonald, investment strategy at Hargreaves Lansdown. Thank you very much indeed.
Fliss, thank you. 29 minutes past six. Mike's here with the morning sport. Morning, Mike.
Hello, Nick. Good morning. Let's start with football, shall we? And the Scottish Premiership, because we saw the first Edinburgh derby of the new season last night.
A massive roar from the away end. And a wonderful solo goal from Josh McPake seals the derby. The first one of the season for Heart of Midlothian. It finishes here at Easter Road. 10-man Hibs 1, Hearts 3.
Yes, an entertaining Edinburgh derby ended in a 3-1 victory for last season's Premiership runners-up Hearts over rivals Hibs. Elsewhere, the new Premier League season continues later with the first round, the first match of the latest round of fixtures this evening. Ipswich playing Liverpool at Portman Road, whilst in London, the newly expanded Women's Super League season starts again with last year's surprise package. London City Lionesses hosting Manchester United. Now, unlike every other side in the WSL, London City do not have an equivalent men's club. Here's their owner, the American businesswoman, Michelle Kang.
We're the only independent team. So everything we do is really 100% with our female athletes in mind. And that's a huge difference. And I think a lot of players love to see what that vision could help them really thrive as a player and as a team.
Well, that part of a longer interview with the London City owner, Michelle Kang, which you'll be able to hear later in the programme. Next to tennis, and there are no British players left in the singles at this year's US Open after defeat for Fran Jones and Harriet Dart yesterday. Jones had made the second round in New York for the very first time, so how does she reflect on her time at Flushing Meadows?
Content, maybe not happy. I think there's still a lot of things that I can improve, and that's a positive in itself, but just need to get out there and keep giving myself those opportunities.
Elsewhere, there was a shock exit in New York for the third seed, Felix Auger-Aliassime, who lost to Karen Khachanov in the second round. Meanwhile, off the court, the former Wimbledon finalist Nick Kyrgios has accepted a one-month ban from tennis for testing positive for cocaine. The length of the suspension means Kyrgios is already eligible to return to the sport. Here's Russell Fuller.
Kyrgios has satisfied investigators he took cocaine out of competition, and a three-month ban has been reduced to just one as the Australian has already begun a treatment programme. Kyrgios took the drug at a nightclub in Magaluf 2 days before his match and less than 24 hours before the start of the tournament, when he would have been considered in competition. Kyrgios has previously been very critical of the tennis integrity system and argued the recent bans received by Jannik Sinner and Iga Świątek of 3 months and 1 month respectively, were overly lenient.
In cricket, England's women secured a comfortable series win last night as they hammered Ireland by 6 wickets in the second ODI at Derby. Fast bowler Izzy Wong took her first international 5-wicket haul in that match, and we'll hear from her in the next hour of the programme. And finally, in rugby league, Bradford ended their run of 7 straight defeats last night with victory over Castleford.
Thank you, Mike.
On BBC iPlayer.
There is a problem. A British contractor was shot in Svalbard up in the Arctic Circle.
Put down the gun!
This is DCI Silver.
I know who she is.
We have to keep things contained.
They go to war over this.
This is not the fight you can win.
The Russians are here, and it looks like they've come mob-handed.
Let's all stay calm. Okay, no one needs to get hurt. We need backup.
Amy, no!
The new series of Vigil. Watch on BBC iPlayer.
27 minutes to 7 now. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson at the Reform Conference in Birmingham, Anna Foster in Salford, and Jane Steele has a summary of the news.
Argentina's President Javier Milei has raised tensions with the UK over the Falkland Islands, warning it will impose economic sanctions on British and Israeli firms which exploit oil in the area. Mr. Milei made his televised address after being emboldened by Donald Trump's suggestion that he might reconsider the American stance on the Falklands. A British task force pushed out Argentina's military when it invaded the islands in the 1982 war. Undercover filming appears to show a senior aide to Nigel Farage suggesting a way to get around electoral law to try to secure a foreign donation of £500,000 for Reform UK. Dan Dukes was filmed meeting a man posing as the British-based son of a rich American businessman. The footage was gathered by Verbatim Investigations, a group founded by journalists from the Centre for Climate Reporting and broadcast by Channel 4. Reform, which is holding its party conference in Birmingham, denies any wrongdoing. It says it's the target of a hoax perpetuated by a foreign-funded climate change activist posing as would-be party donors. Two hydropower workers have been rescued alive from a collapsed tunnel in Nepal more than a week after a flash flood destroyed communities there and in the border area of Tibet. Emergency teams say they called into one of the tunnels at the Trishuli power project and several voices responded beyond a blocked section. BBC News understands that the government will approve a new gas field off the coast of Aberdeen as soon as this month. The Jackdaw project was first approved by the Conservative government in 2022, but environmental groups successfully challenged the decision in the courts. The British Army is to stop large non-essential training exercises to save money. Units at home will continue to train but won't take part in large live fire exercises or war games on training areas such as Salisbury Plain. The government is under pressure to increase defence spending to 3% of national income by the end of the decade.
Jane, thank you very much indeed. It's now 25 minutes to 7. Did Nigel Farage's senior aide suggest a way to get round electoral law to secure a foreign donation of £500,000 for Reform UK? That is the allegation made by undercover reporters posing as wealthy donors, which was broadcast last night by Channel 4. Our political correspondent Joe Pike joins me here in our cubbyhole at the Reform Party conference in Birmingham. Not quite glamorous enough to call it a studio. Now, look, the footage, Joe, shows Nigel Farage sharing oysters and champagne with people he clearly believes are wealthy donors. We know now that they were posing as donors and telling them that their plan to give the party money was all above board. So are the party this morning taking the allegations seriously or trying to dismiss them?
Well, what is most interesting, I think, Nick, is that they seem to be doing a bit of both. They've said that the party has been the target of what they call a hoax perpetuated by foreign-funded climate change activists, because the filming was done by a group called Verbatim Investigations. They were founded by the Centre for Climate Reporting. But Reform also say they've launched an investigation. The party has robust vetting processes for prospective donors, and they say that's approved by the Electoral Commission. If your listeners haven't seen or heard this, and it's definitely worth watching in full, the key figure here is Dan Dukes. Not a national name, but for us in Westminster, somebody who's well known. If you want an interview with Nigel Farage, he is the man you ring. He's seen as understanding the Reform leader very well. He's filmed meeting a man posing, as you say, as the British-based son of a rich American businessman, and Dukes appears to suggest a way of getting around electoral law. Of course, the key sort of bit of background here is only those registered to vote in the UK or companies registered can donate to political parties. And as you say, Nick, what is also revealing is the texture of that undercover filming, the posh hotels and the feel for sort of wealthy people, I suppose, you get. Dan Dukes has been approached for comment. The Electoral Commission says information about any potential attempt to evade the controls on donations is for the police to consider. As for the police, the Met have told us it's aware of the media reports, but it's not begun an investigation.
We're going to be hearing from the former boss of the Electoral Commission later on. They're the people who kind of look after the law around donations to political party, but as they say, the police are the ones who have to investigate if they choose to do so. Now, we're talking at the beginning of a conference. Everywhere you go here in Birmingham, you see this phrase, don't you, about first 100 days. This was meant to be about turning the page from a pretty difficult summer.
It was, and it's not going to plan, Nick. The point that one reform strategist made to me yesterday, before this broke, was that their conference is actually shorter than the Conservatives and Labour. It's only really 2 days, or as they said, two news cycles, and those news cycles are very precious. At least today's news cycle, as far as today, and we're not going to be talking about Nigel Farage's big speech, or as you say, this plan for the policies they'd institute in their first 100 days in government if they get in. But responding to all of this, one advantage for reform, and they say this privately, around these sorts of stories is that they involve people that few outside of Westminster heard of. They're complicated. They're not easy for voters to digest. I think that's true. I think the difference here potentially is that voters have the opportunity to watch the conversations, make up their own minds. And at the very least, I think it gives you a picture of the instincts of some of those people in the party. If we take a step back as well, the wider problem for reform is evident in opinion polls. Their 15 months of constantly leading those polls are now over. That's partly, of course, because Andy Burnham's here, because of Restore Rupert Lowe's party, but also because of these regular headlines about party finances. It's not just really about the reform base, Nick. It's about Tory waverers. Those are the ones Nigel Farage needs if he's to get into number 10.
Joe Pike, thank you very much indeed. In a little less than an hour's time, I'll be examining the suggestion that some have, maybe some people listening, hope that what is regarded by a few as the souffle, the Reform UK polling souffle, has collapsed. People here are pretty confident. They're a bit more resilient than that.
It's 21 minutes to 7 now. Tensions between Argentina and the UK over the Falklands have risen again. This is after President Javier Milei made a national address last night saying that there was growing support for Argentinian claims to the islands.
Across the world, winds of change favourable to our claim are blowing. President Trump said recently the US is re-evaluating its historical position regarding Las Malvinas. This path is not in vain.
President Milei also went on to say something quite key, actually. He would impose economic sanctions on firms which exploit oil close to the British overseas territory. Well, our correspondent Will Grant was watching. He's been telling me more.
Well, I do think it is the ramping up of tensions again between Argentina and the UK government over the Falklands issue. I mean, specifically, we're seeing that President Javier Milei is talking about winds of change that favour the Argentine claim to the Falklands. What he did is he started off his address to the nation, surrounded by his cabinet in the presidential palace, by saying he was going to set out to the world Argentina's position and summed it up in those four words that is so often the refrain from Argentina: Las Malvinas son Argentinas, the Falklands are Argentine, and then went on to explain why his country considers that the UK occupation, as he put it, of the Falklands was illegal, and therefore the islanders can have no right to self-determination because the land itself has been taken illegally. But the reason that he went on to talk about winds of change favouring Argentina was twofold. One is because he's going to introduce a bill in Parliament to bring sanctions against oil companies that are planning to begin exploration of an oil field, the Sea Lion oil field off the coast of the Falklands within 2 years. And the other is apparent movement, or at least change within Donald Trump's view of this issue, that he said he's going to reevaluate the US position on the Falklands.
How much of this, in your assessment, Will, is likely to go beyond simply words and have real meaning or impact?
It's in previous years, you would say that it just, that the escalation rises and falls, and it happens cyclically. If ever a president in Argentina is in trouble, they turn to the Falklands issues as a way of galvanizing their support, of perhaps as a rallying cry to voters. And there is an election for Javier Milei next year. We shouldn't leave that out of our analysis. But at the same time, I think what's different here is, whereas previously it's been about discussions of sovereignty and of self-determination and so on, this is very much about natural resources and the exploitation of natural resources. He basically said that Argentina will not allow the idea that the British government takes from under our seas the 1.7 billion barrels estimated to be in that oil field, and has announced as well the creation of a new naval base in the south. So taken all together, I do think this one is far more serious than perhaps other escalations to this point, and it comes around both the context of Donald Trump saying that he's reviewing Washington's position on the Falklands, which has traditionally been neutral, but recognizing of British control of the territory. And, of course, the fact that the FIFA World Cup, there was this moment that seemed to galvanize people after Argentina beat England in the World Cup, and some players waved the banner that said that line again, Las Malvinas son Argentinas.
Will Grant, thank you.
17 minutes to seven now. Buying a brand new home is a dream for many, but which all too often can turn into a nightmare. That's the evidence coming from the New Homes Ombudsman Service, which investigates disputes between home buyers and developers. We're joined by our housing correspondent, Tara Welsh. Morning to you, Tara. The figure suggests that complaints have more than tripled about brand new homes. How so?
Yeah, I mean, well, this is, you know, we've got to remember this is a fairly new service. It only started accepting complaints in 2023. And I must say, both the Ombudsman Service itself and the Home Builders Federation say it's down to the scheme basically being open to more people, more developers signing up, and more awareness rather than a widespread quality crisis. But it does highlight something we're seeing at the BBC with people having problems with their brand new homes. And the real issue here is that the Ombudsman says that only 2/3 of developers are signed up to its service. And so a good amount of new homeowners aren't protected. And those are the ones, he says, are often open to the worst practices. Now, the previous and current government said they would make the service statutory. This came out of the Building Safety Act following the Grenfell Tower tragedy. And the government still hasn't done that. And we've spoken to dozens of people across the UK who've experienced serious problems in brand new homes. You know, it could be mould and damp. And I've been to some of these homes, and I'm talking about thick mould behind plasterboard, and even structural defects. We've even spoken to people that have had to move out of their new home while it's remediated. And the select committee...
Yeah, sorry, you finished, Tara.
I was just going to say, the select committee looking at this, you know, has warned that if we're going to build 1.5 million homes, we need a better system in place to deal with complaints.
Tara Welsh, our housing correspondent, thank you.
We'll look more on that just before 8 o'clock this morning on the programme as well. Now, the government has pledged to clean up England's high streets, end rough sleeping, build thousands more homes. But when it comes to new houses, as we were hearing there, MPs across the Commons wanted to know if there would be things like the roads and the sewers, health services, basically the infrastructure to match it. Our correspondent Susan Hume reports on Yesterday in Parliament.
The Prime Minister has promised growth in every postcode, but some MPs are worried about the growth of their postcode.
Why are Labour so determined to cover South Essex in concrete and gridlock our roads purely for ideological reasons? Yeah.
The Conservative Marc Francois, who was angry at the prospect of 100,000 new houses in his area. Local opposition is one of the reasons why government after government has promised to tackle the housing crisis in England and build more homes, but all of them have struggled to turn the promises into front doors, walls and roofs. Setting out her solution, the Housing Secretary Angela Rayner pointed to mandatory housing targets, new planning powers for mayors and a commitment to building more social homes.
Solving the housing crisis isn't just a moral cause, it's an economic necessity. Every shovel in the ground means new investment, new jobs, growth in every postcode.
But Marc Francois wasn't the only MP to point to the downside. Despite some scoffing from Labour MPs, a Lib Dem, Vicky Slade, said some communities in her Dorset constituency had doubled in size in recent years, yet with...
No extra roads, It's not funny. The people there have no extra roads, no water treatment plants, no new GPs, and the remaining areas of Greenbelt, specifically designated to separate them, have disappeared. Right. Their communities are being forced to build thousands more, 7,000 a year in Dorset, similar to Essex. But, Madam Deputy Speaker, they're not selling. These houses are lying empty.
And she added,
the local population can't afford them. The social housing providers don't want them because they're built under old standards, and we run the risk of them being filled with holidaymakers.
She said there really needed to be a review of housing targets to make sure they matched local needs. Angela Rayner was sympathetic.
I appreciate, Madam Deputy Speaker, if there are empty houses that local people can't get and the infrastructure's not there, I can fully appreciate why people would be frustrated with that.
And she promised her government would do things differently, making changes to the planning policy framework. But even some Labour MPs had concerns, albeit expressed more delicately. Labour's Nezil Kalliskin was worried that GPs in her Barking constituency already had 20% more patients to look after than the national average.
And it's particularly bad at Barking Riverside, where there is new development. Unlike members opposite, I strongly support new homes being built because my constituents feel the pain of having a housing crisis. But not having GPs, not having schools and other crucial infrastructure means that they are let down.
Angela Rayner admitted there was a bit of a theme emerging.
I am acutely aware that with the housing needs to come the infrastructure that people desperately need. I don't think they're NIMBYs, Madam Deputy Speaker. I think they raise genuine concerns and I've heard them loud and clear.
The Housing Secretary's statement also covered plans to improve local communities, including a pledge to offer all rough sleepers a route off the streets by Christmas. Labour's Deirdre Costigan felt a different approach would be needed in her West London constituency.
Many of our rough sleepers don't have the right to stay or work in the country, so the council can't legally help them off the streets. Will she meet with me to find ways of making it easier for this group of rough sleepers to reconnect with family abroad and return home with dignity?
The Housing Secretary said she'd work with the Home Office on that. But Katie Lamb, who this week became the Conservative Shadow Housing Secretary, was sceptical about the promise to end rough sleeping, given Andy Burnham's track record when he was Manchester Mayor.
Can the Secretary of State explain why the Prime Minister failed to solve rough sleeping in Greater Manchester, bearing in mind that it increased when both the local authority and the national government were run by the Labour Party? And can she explain why anybody should believe that he will be able to do so nationally?
Angela Rayner said that rough sleeping had fallen in Greater Manchester to start with, but the programme had actually attracted homeless people from other places into the area. Nonetheless, she detected a constructive tone from her new opposite number, and it gave her hopes.
She comes with a job of a good, strong track record. I believe her grandparents met whilst they were delivering leaflets for the Labour Party, so that's a good start.
Some Labour MPs beckoned her over. Katie Lamb just laughed. Politics is not a hereditary condition.
Susan Hume reporting there on Yesterday in Parliament. It's now 10 to 7. Any parent, any carer of a child with a severe allergy fears the moment they're not in control of what their loved one eats or comes into contact with. This week, new protection for children with allergies come into force in state-funded schools across England. The changes that have become known as Benedict's Law were introduced after five-year-old Benedict Blythe died following a severe allergic reaction caused by contact with milk at his school. We're joined by Benedict's mother, Helen Blythe. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
This is something you've been fighting for a very long time. I'm sure you won't see it as a moment to celebrate, but is there some relief that you think things will improve?
Yeah, there absolutely is. I mean, in the last week, this has started to come into force as children have returned to school. And we've had messages from teachers who've expressed, you know, kind of, I think, gratitude and relief that they were finally getting the support that they've been calling for to make sure that they could protect the children in their care. But overwhelmingly, we've had parents saying, I was terrified, absolutely terrified of sending my child off to school this week. And I'm so relieved and it feels like a weight off in them going there and me feeling like they're going to be safer. And so, yeah,
it doesn't give a reason. Spell out how things will be different for the child, for the parent, and obviously for the teacher as well.
So historically, there were no real requirements for schools. They had to make adaptations or changes for children with medical conditions, but what those were was not explicit. So this time round, they will need to have training for all school staff, not just teaching staff, but all staff in the school must be trained to understand what allergies are, how to prevent an allergic reaction, how to manage risk, and how to respond in an emergency. They'll also need to have a school-wide policy and an individual healthcare plan for every child. There's also an expectation that schools will have spare adrenaline auto-injectors, so EpiPens, and in school that they can use in an emergency if needed.
You talk of giving greater support to teachers. Inevitably, that raises questions about resource, doesn't it? More staff, more money for the training and so on. Is the money there?
The money is not there. And as part of our campaign, we'd wanted this to be fully funded. And I think it's while we're really pleased that this has come in and schools are absolutely taking this seriously, it's a big ask for them. You know, this was rolled out 6 weeks ago, just before the summer holidays. And in that time, they've had to turn around very quickly, putting these measures in place and suddenly rustling up, you know, several hundred pounds to fund this. I know the government is committed to looking at how to make that more affordable and easier to access. But it's definitely something that we hope will come sooner rather than later to help the schools to do the right thing.
And for now, it is state schools in England. Is there a hope that this will spread to independent schools and beyond England?
Yeah, so we secured primary legislation. So this sits within the Children's Wellbeing and Schools Act that had all sent back in May. So from 2027, this will then be made a legal duty for all schools, which includes rolling it out to independent and free-paying special schools. So next sort of spring probably means that all schools in England will be held to this, which is amazing, far more than we probably could have ever hoped for when we started our campaign.
Well, I'm sure there'll be lots of people thanking you, congratulating you for your campaign. Helen Blythe, the mother of little Benedict, thank you very much indeed.
It is 6 minutes to seven now. Giorgia Meloni's government in Italy has broken the record to become the longest running since World War II. And for a country that's had 68 governments in 80 years, that is quite the achievement. So what has been the secret to her success? Beppe Sevenini is a columnist for Italy's largest daily newspaper, Corriere della Sera. Good morning.
Good morning to you, Anna.
I feel like before we talk about Giorgia Meloni specifically, a bit of background and context would be useful. Why is it that Italian politics have seen so much flux over the last few decades?
The electoral law basically yours produced steady governments until a few years ago now, and we know what happened since. And in Italy, produced lots of small parties fighting each other, and before the election, after the election, but then Giorgia Meloni, she realized she had a majority and basically no opposition for 4 years.
So what is it? Do you think it's about the politics that she is pushing? Do you think it's about her as a person? Where do you think that success in holding a government together for so long lies?
I think she failed to keep her promises. That was the trick. Because what she promised was, you know, we're going to leave or fight the European Union. We're gonna fight immigration, remigration, you name it. I remember the day of Brexit. I was in London and I was on television with her. She was an MP. And my God, she was lecturing me and everyone else about how wonderful Brexit is, that at last Britain had left the cage of the European Union. And she promised to fight the European Union. The moment she stepped into office, all that was gone. She became a reliable European leader, staying with the other, supporting Ukraine, criticizing Putin, which he praised, she praised in the past, and she had the gut to tell Trump enough at some point. And we're talking about a right, definitely a right-wing leader. So she belonged to the Trump family, but she had basically she didn't do almost anything that she promised. Thanks God.
That's interesting, isn't it, that would be ultimately the key to success. And what about the situation looking forward? How much longer do you think she can hold on to power for?
Oh, definitely. We're going to have an election next year, probably in the sort of late spring, early summer or early fall, we'll see. And it's almost certain it's up to her. And she may stay in office, but basically because her hold on this, on the right side of sort of right side of politics in Italy is strong. And the opposition is, as usual, typically of the Italian left, divided and quarrelsome. So she may stay there. She's reassuring. She fought her campaign, as, you know, lots of politicians do, even Starmer in Britain, you remember that, on the fact that, enough of the past. We've seen what the other lot does. Trust me, enough. And on the protests, you know. But once she was in, she plays the reassurance card. People are worried about the wars, worried about the economy, worried about salaries that in Italy are far too low. And she say, don't worry, I'm here, I'm young, I'm energetic, I'm not an extremist.
Yeah,
she basically trying to be the Italian Thatcher.
It is fascinating, isn't it, how, you know, different countries, different politics, but there's a lot of it that that looks very familiar, regardless of where you are. Beppe Sevenini, columnist for Corriere della Sera, thank you.
Let's get the latest weather forecast now from Sarah Keith Lucas.
Thank you, Nick. Good morning. It's a breezy day out there today. Some rain around at times, and things are going to be turning fresher and brighter later in the day. We'll start with the southern half of England and all of Wales. Currently, there's some heavy rain, particularly affecting the Midlands towards Norfolk as well, and that's just drifting its way south, that band of rain. But as it does so, it'll be fizzling out. So by the time it reaches the south coast of England by around about lunchtime, not much rain left, just a band of cloud, really. And behind that, things will be brightening up with some sunny spells this afternoon, but it will feel windy, and temperatures will be around 20 to 23 degrees here. Further north, so we're looking at all of Northern England, Northern Ireland and Scotland. We've got some outbreaks of showery rain around first thing, and it's going to be a day of sunny spells developing and showers continuing. The bulk of them will be across the northwest of Scotland, around the north of Northern Ireland as well. Fewer further south and east, but where you do get those showers could be heavy and thundery, and it's going to be particularly windy in the north, with gusts in the north of Scotland around 40 to 50 miles an hour, and temperatures here around about 18 to 20 degrees. Things look mostly dry and settled, those high pressure builds into tomorrow.
Thank you, Sarah. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford, Nick Robinson in Birmingham.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Friday, the 4th of September. The headlines today: Argentina says it will impose economic sanctions on oil firms working near the Falkland Islands in a move which raises tensions with the UK. Undercover filming broadcast by Channel 4 appears to show a senior aide to the Reform leader Nigel Farage trying to get around electoral law to secure a foreign donation of £500,000. The party denies any wrongdoing. Two survivors have been rescued from a tunnel in Nepal. They've been located and pulled to safety 9 days after the flooding disaster which devastated the border area with Tibet.
Also in this hour, leaky taps, windows that don't fit, uneven floors. Why is the number of complaints about problems in new homes tripled in the past year? And we finally have an answer on the Jackdaw gas field. Simon Jack will reveal all. That's all after the BBC News, read for us this morning by Jane Steele.
Argentina's president Javier Milei has heightened tensions with the UK over the Falkland Islands, warning that he will impose economic sanctions on companies which exploit oil close to the British Overseas Territory. Mr. Milei made his televised address after being emboldened by Donald Trump's suggestion that he might reconsider the American stance on the Falklands. A British task force pushed out Argentina's military when it invaded the islands in the 1982 war. Mr. Milei insisted any production by a British-Israeli venture at the Sea Lion oil field, around 130 miles from the Falklands, represented a clear danger. Our correspondent Will Grant reports.
President Milei announced his sanctions plans surrounded by his cabinet at the presidential palace. He began by setting out to the world, as he put it, his country's position. "The Falklands are Argentine," he said. The British had forcibly occupied the islands in 1833, he argued, and said there could be no legitimate claim to self-determination by the islanders. However, the crux was a plan to introduce a bill to Parliament to impose sanctions on energy firms planning to begin oil exploration off the Falklands.
Hoy nuestra causa nacional enfrenta un peligro claro y urgente.
Today, our national cause faces a clear and urgent danger and demands a proportional response, he said. Two oil companies, one Israeli and one British, are due to begin exploration work in the Sea Lion oil field off the Falklands coast within 2 years, something Mr. Milei said Argentina could not allow. He also announced plans for a naval base in southern Argentina. The UK government has always insisted that Falkland Islanders are British, with a right to determine their own future. Mr. Milei added that President Trump was re-evaluating the US position on the Falklands. There are winds of change in the world that are favourable to our claim, he said, arguing that in Argentina, Washington had a trustworthy partner, while he described the United Kingdom as a nation in decline.
Undercover filming broadcast by Channel 4 appears to show a senior aide to Nigel Farage suggesting a way to get around electoral law to try to secure a foreign donation of £500,000 for Reform UK. The party denies any wrongdoing. Our political correspondent Harry Farley reports from Reform UK's conference in Birmingham.
The adviser, Dan Jukes, is filmed meeting a man posing as the British-based son of a rich American. Under electoral law, only those registered to vote here or companies registered here are permissible donors to political parties. The undercover reporter tells Mr. Jukes of his concern that because of this, his father wouldn't be able to directly donate to Reform. Mr. Jukes appears to suggest the donation should be made by the son, although the funds would have been made available to him from his father. The undercover filming was done by a group called Verbatim Investigations, which was founded by journalists from the Centre for Climate Reporting. A Reform UK spokesperson said it had launched an investigation, but said the party had been the target of a hoax perpetuated by foreign-funded climate change activists. Dan Jukes has been approached for comment.
Emergency teams in Nepal have rescued two survivors who've been trapped in a tunnel since the devastating floods 9 days ago. Officials say they expect at least 39 people will be pulled alive out of the Trishuli 3A tunnel. Our South Asia correspondent Azadeh Mashiri reports from one of the worst affected areas, the district of Rasuwa.
Amid all the devastation, this is a moment of hope. Rescuers suddenly heard voices in the Trishuli 3A tunnel more than a week after the flood that has devastated border areas. Rescuers made their way through flooded tunnels choked with mud and debris. The crew had previously blasted a hole in the crown of the tunnel and had descended on ropes. Excavators have also been used and oxygen is being pumped in. The survivors are now being airlifted to army hospitals for treatment and the hope is more will follow.
BBC News understands that the government will approve a new gas field off the coast of Aberdeen as soon as this month. The Jackdaw project was first approved by the Conservative government in 2022, but environmental groups successfully challenged the decision in the courts, arguing that officials had not given enough consideration to the impact of burning fossil fuels. Here's our business editor, Simon Jack.
Jackdaw could provide up to 6% of the UK's gas supplies at full production, according to its owners, Adura. The UK relies on imports from Norway and the US for more than half its gas needs. A consultation on a new application for Jackdaw closed in August, and the BBC understands that approval may come as soon as mid-September. The environmental campaign group Uplift said Jackdaw's true contribution to UK gas supplies would be closer to 2% and would do nothing to cut energy bills. The Department for Energy, Security and Net Zero said it did not comment on speculation.
The army has been told to stop large non-essential training exercises to save money. The government is increasing defence spending to 2.5% of national income by next year, and pressure is building to reach 3% by the end of the decade. Our defence correspondent Jonathan Beale reports.
Those British Army units not on operations have been told to halt plans for large training exercises because of the financial pressures facing the MOD. An army spokesperson said instead it would prioritise activity that contributed most directly to readiness and operational effectiveness. The army says it's investing £2 billion to transform training by learning the lessons from the war in Ukraine. But the pause in other training will only highlight the MOD's continuing struggle to make ends meet and the growing pressure on the government to further increase defence spending.
The Environment Secretary has suggested people should stock up on food ahead of a government campaign about preparing for future national emergencies. Dame Angela Eagle said that events such as El Niño, the weather pattern which can increase the risk of droughts and floods around the world, needed to be taken seriously. Here's our political correspondent Jack Fenwick.
Dame Angela Eagle, the new Environment Secretary, will oversee the building of the country's first new reservoir since 1992, as well as changes to farming, which ministers hope will make the UK more adaptable to a changing climate. She said the naturally occurring El Niño weather phenomenon could lead to drier summers, wetter winters and more extreme storms in the UK. In the coming months, the Cabinet Office will launch a campaign on preparing for emergencies. Dame Angela told The Guardian newspaper that households would be a lot better off if they stocked up on things like canned food and urged people to take steps to ensure they were more resilient.
In what's described as a world first, a man in the United States has been given a genetically modified pig kidney, which enabled him to stay off dialysis for 9 months. Doctors said the animal organ was used as a temporary bridge while the man waited for a transplant from a human donor. Here's our health correspondent, Dominic Hughes.
Tim Andrews had been diagnosed with end-stage kidney disease when he received a kidney from a genetically modified Yucatan miniature pig in January 2025. He lived successfully with the new organ for nearly 9 months before moving to short-term dialysis and receiving a human kidney. This procedure marks the longest dialysis-free survival after a pig kidney transplant in a living human and is also the first transition from a pig to a human kidney transplantation. The idea is that faced with a shortage of organs, this type of operation can help bridge the gap between end-stage kidney failure and finding a suitable donor organ.
Dominic Hughes reporting.
Thank you, Jane. It's just coming round to 9 minutes past seven. Is Argentina gearing up for a new push to retake the Falklands? Well, overnight, President Javier Milei has added to growing tensions by promising to sanction firms which explore oil fields close to the British overseas territory. His national address from the presidential palace, flanked by his cabinet, is the latest salvo in a war of words over the islands.
Across the world, winds of change favourable to our claim are blowing. President Trump said recently the US is re-evaluating its historical position regarding Las Malvinas. This path is not in vain.
Well, on the question of why now, the US president's shifting tone could be in part responsible for that. President Trump hinted on GB News that the US wouldn't necessarily leap to the UK's aid if Argentina did attempt to invade the Falklands.
Look, I was there when they had the first war. That was a long time ago. And I watched it so carefully. And you comported yourselves very well. You took it back pretty strongly. But it's a long way away. That's a big trip. It's a long way. So your country's not doing well. Don't forget, you get a big percentage of your oil from the Strait of Hormuz. And you weren't there to help me. Your country was not there to help me.
Well, Lord MacDonald, Simon MacDonald, was the head of the Foreign Office between 2015 and 2020 and joins us. Good morning.
Good morning, Anna.
We've just heard from Downing Street on this. Short and simple quote, the Falkland Islands are a British overseas territory and will remain so for as long as the islanders wish. What is your assessment of what we're seeing at the moment from Argentina?
I think it is, as you portray, it is in response to President Trump's remarks. They see an opening diplomatically and they're exploiting it. They're doing it in an aggressive way, which is designed to provoke the reaction you've just read out from Downing Street. But there are a couple of important things in the background, which I think we should not lose sight of. One is that the number of Falkland Islanders is very small. 2,000 people approximately, and at the moment they have an absolute right to self-determination. But they can only exercise that right if the United Kingdom backs them up very, very expensively. They have no incentive ever to change their minds, even though it's costing the Brits about £500 million per year. So I think this absolute lock that they have is something that needs to be looked at again. And the geography needs to be looked at again. As President Trump says, this is a group of islands a long, long way from the United Kingdom. So our strategic interest in the middle of the 21st century is not the same as it was when we went to war.
Mm. Well, that's something I'd like to pick up on in just a second, actually. I suppose first, what should, and you talked there about things being looked at again, what should the UK approach to this be?
To have negotiations with the Argentinians, which were happening before the Falklands War, some sort of arrangement which would protect rights of the Falkland Islanders, but recognised that they are very remote and very difficult for the United Kingdom to defend. And the other thing we should remember is that even though the Americans came down on our side in the end in 1982, it was a close-run thing. Half the administration even then thought this was a colonial issue and that the United States was on the wrong side of the argument. What was decisive then was the act of aggression. That was completely unacceptable, and that justified the war. This self-determination angle was added along the way, and I'm suggesting it is not absolute. When a small group of people need a much larger group of people to spend huge amounts of money, then that right is not absolute.
The fact that the oil fields, which are about to be explored, have come into this overnight is interesting. Should giving away or sharing some of that revenue potentially with Argentina be on the cards?
Part of the negotiation for sure, but also relevant is that the South Atlantic is one of the last pristine environments on planet Earth. So the environmental aspects of this project also need a very careful look, because it could be the global interest to leave this particular oil underneath the seabed.
As I said, I think it's worth exploring also in a little more detail, bearing in mind that there are a wide swathe of people listening to this morning for whom the Falklands is something that perhaps they've read about or heard about, might not have lived through. It was a long time ago now, and as you point out, a very long way away. So what is the current interest, I suppose, in that small population, as you point out, that small group of islands for both sides?
As you're suggesting, the war has an iconic status for the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom showed Argentina and the whole world that when push came to shove, we were able to defend our interests, that the act of aggression was addressed and reversed. And that was very important to our standing in the world in the 1980s. But that is 44 years ago. Mrs. Thatcher, who led this was the key moment of her prime ministership. As long as she was in charge, as long as she was alive, no one was going to have another look. But Mrs. Thatcher died 13 years ago. I think it is overdue that we have another fundamental look. But as I said right at the start, the fact that Argentina starts in such an aggressive way makes all the British hackles rise, when we should be, I think, taking a more dispassionate look at what our actual long-term interests are.
Final thought, Lord MacDonald. What you've laid out there very eloquently, are those views that are shared by the current administration?
Not at all. I am a lone voice on this, Anna, but you've given me the opportunity to put an alternative view to your listeners.
And interesting it was to hear as well, Lord MacDonald, Simon MacDonald, former head of the Foreign Office between 2015 and 2020. Thank you for joining us.
7:15 now. Good morning again from the Reform Party conference in Birmingham, a morning on which the party is once again facing fresh questions about the money it accepts from the super rich.
Do we just order food?
Yeah.
Oysters, please. Oysters, please. Should we do four each?
I'll have half a dozen, please.
That's amazing.
Cheers.
Last night, Channel 4 News broadcast undercover footage from that oyster and champagne lunch in Clacton in Essex, Nigel Farage's seat, of course, in which Mr. Farage and his aide, Dan Jukes, appear to meet with an American who wants to give the party £500,000, and with his son, who's based here in the UK.
Now, in reality, they're not donors at all. They are a reporter with something called Verbatim Investigations, founded by journalists from something called the Center for Climate Reporting, and an actor that they've hired who's posing as the American father. They tell Farage they've been in discussion with his aides, with the man we just heard, Dan Jukes, and also Reform's head of policy, James Orr, in discussion about a donation which would come from the American, but be transferred via his UK-based son, which would, if it were true, be a breach of the law. As you'll hear, Farage tells them it's all above board, and he thanks them.
The mechanism now for this next phase is we've had some discussions with Dan, with James.
It's all above board. Yeah.
All above board. I'm going to be the. It'll be me. So it'll be. I'll be the registered donor. And so I think there'll be some conversations. You know, necessarily. You know, lawyers, back office, and so on. But then Dad will send the money to me, and then as soon as that's done, all of those conversations are had. Then the money's available. So no, we.
Thank you, says Nigel Farage. Earlier in the film, Reform's head of policy, James Orr, appears to suggest to the undercover reporter that his father could pay for something specific, for opinion polling to aid Reform by commissioning opinion polls, which would show how well the party was doing, and they would get picked up by national newspapers.
It could be a great story.
And allows us to be, it all to be completely legit, mm-hmm. at arm's length, nothing untoward about it at all.
Mm-hmm. Great.
In all, Channel 4 News says that Reform commissioned three opinion polls, costing more than £32,000 in all, and that the public was not told who commissioned or funded those polls. Now, Reform UK denies any wrongdoing and claims to have been the target of a hoax perpetuated by foreign-funded climate change activists. But this morning, the chair of the Labour Party, Bridget Phillipson, has written to the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police demanding that there be an inquiry. Let us get our heads around what the law is, what the rules are around polling as well, with Bob Posner, former chief executive of the UK Electoral Commission, which is the body that supervises those laws, and Peter Keldner, former president of the polling company YouGov. Morning to you both.
Good morning. Good
morning, Nick.
Bob, let's start with the basic. What is the law about who can and who cannot give money to a political party that is relevant to what's being discussed here?
Well, it's really very straightforward. Like all democracies, we don't permit foreign money to come in and influence our elections and our democracy. So permissible donors are people who have a sufficient connection to the UK, they're on an electoral register in the UK, or they're a company that's doing business in the UK.
So I, if I happen to have someone who lived in Britain and I was an American, I can't simply say, look, I'll give you the money and you give them the money.
Exactly. And the way the law works, the onus is on the political party to make sure that they do not accept money that is impermissible. They're obliged under the law to take all reasonable steps to identify the donor. That means the true donor. It doesn't mean who fronts up. They need to establish who the true donor is. If there's any doubt, any question mark at all, they mustn't accept the money.
So if they knew, and of course we don't know, these are questions for the Metropolitan Police, if they knew that a donation was coming in reality from abroad, that on the face of it would be a breach of the law.
It would be a breach of the law, and these are criminal offences we're talking about. They're serious matters, and there is a specific criminal offence which is around attempting to evade the law, taking steps to knowingly engage in further impermissible donations. So in addition to breaching the law about permissibility, there is the potential of a very serious criminal offence of trying to evade the law.
Now, there may be some people listening who think there's all sorts of money being given to political parties by the super rich. Some live abroad, some don't live abroad. Does this really matter?
Well, it does matter that the money in our politics is the only money that's there is the money that should be there. The money in politics funds campaigning. Campaigning influences who we vote for us, the voters. It tells us about the political party. And also the system relies upon compliance. It relies upon the integrity of our politicians, our political parties, to make sure that they comply with the law. I mean, after all, they're the people who make our laws.
Bob Posner, former chief executive of the UK Electoral Commission. Thank you. Let's turn now to Peter Kellner, former president. I think I'm right in saying, Peter, of the polling company YouGov, certainly the founder of it. Yeah. There's another dimension to this, isn't there? Can we trust the polls that we read on the front pages of national newspapers? Why is that issue raised by the allegations that have been aired overnight?
I hope we can. JL Partners, the company that did the three polls you referred to, is a perfectly reputable company, and it is a member of an organisation I helped to set up 20 years ago called the British Polling Council, which is a trades body. It's not a statutory body, it's a trades body. But our principal ambition here was to make sure that polls operated to the highest standards. At the heart of this was a transparency. The main rules of the British Polling Council about transparency. And the very first rule in its list of transparency commitments is that when polls figures enter the public domain, they must include reference, I'm quoting here, they must include reference to the client commissioning the survey. And what appears to have happened here is that JL Partners did a perfectly technically proper poll, but did not reveal to the Telegraph or the Times who the client was. And if we go by what Channel 4 showed last night, it would seem that was a deliberate wish on the part of the clients that the pollster should not tell the media. But if that is exactly what
just explain,
what's
Peter,
happened,
why, forgive me, just explain why you might want to hide who is giving money to commission a poll, and why a political party wants a poll on the front page of a newspaper. It'll seem naive to some people who follow politics as you and I do every day, but it's about shaping the narrative, isn't it?
It is about shaping the narrative. I mean, look, often it makes no difference. And curiously, it's not clear to me that had the Times and the Telegraph published the identity of the client, it would have made necessarily a great difference. But our view as pollsters was that pollsters needed to be transparent. You know, we should make sure that where we were commissioned with money, or indeed asked without money to conduct a particular poll, we should always make clear who the client was.
Peter Kellner, thank you very much indeed. Reform UK, just to repeat, denies any wrongdoing and claims to have been the target of a hoax. We'll hear from their deputy leader after 10 past eight. And the two newspapers that carried these polls have also put out statements. The Telegraph saying we're reviewing our future relationship with this polling company as we believe we've been misled. And the Times says it was not made aware of Reform's involvement in commissioning and arranging payment of the poll. Many questions still to be answered.
It's 24 minutes past seven now.
I book you.
That was the dramatic moment that two workers were rescued from inside a hydro power tunnel in Nepal just in the last couple of hours. An incredible 9 days after those flash floods that killed more than 1,200 people. Many more are still missing. Azadeh Mashiri, our South Asia correspondent, is in Nepal. Azadeh, just describe that rescue for us. What happened?
It was an incredible moment because there are hundreds of workers trapped in tunnels across Nepal in border areas. And given the fact that it is 9 days now after the flood, hopes for survival were fading. And yet we've now seen this incredible moment where these two workers, Sanjaya Shah and Kabir Mahajan, are pulled from the darkness, taken to safety. And they do both require medical attention, but it's a moment that many hadn't imagined they'd see at this point. But on Friday, as workers were excavating all the mud and the debris from the tunnel, as they were pumping air, hoping to keep people inside alive, they started hearing cries and voices from inside. That's what made them understand that there is truly a chance for survival here. And now that both Sanjaya and Kabir are alive, there are still 39 workers inside. That's what the Nepal's Ministry of Energy has told us. And they hope that means there will be more survivors to follow them.
And not just Azadeh, as far as I can tell, this one tunnel. There are different tunnels, different places, various rescue operations going on to try and find. Because, I mean, that's the greatest chance of survival, really. Anybody who was out on the banks has been swept away. So that's really where they're focusing, trying to find people who may have survived.
Yes, I've spoken to various workers of some of these tunnels. The ones who survived were mostly the people who were working outside the tunnel that day. What one man told me yesterday is that typically when there are earthquakes and floods, tunnel workers run into the tunnels because they believe those are the safest places to go. There are also underground chambers in a lot of these tunnels that will have pockets of air, will have stores of food, and that's why emergency teams hope that that means they will survive. But having said that, there are other tunnels. So, for example, there was a rescue operation at UT16. It's a tunnel closer to where I am here in the district of Rasua, where not only was that tunnel choked with mud and debris, flooded, it's also been raining, which means more water was pouring in, but there have also been boulders that have fallen in these tunnels as well. And so there they did find human remains yesterday. And so the hopes of people being alive in that tunnel are fading. Yet this one in Trishuli 3A, clearly there is a chance that the 39 others that are trapped in there could be alive as well. It's just a very complex operation. And it's taken a lot to get to this point because rescuers had to excavate the mud and debris. They've had to use controlled explosions at the crown of the tunnel to enter. They've used rafts at times to go through the floodwaters. And so it isn't an easy process. But with Kabir and Sanjaya now alive, the hope is that we may see more miraculous rescues like this one. And after the devastation of the past week, the hundreds of bodies and that have been recovered, there's a lot of hope that this could mean something entirely different for the future of the next few days.
Yeah, many people hoping that. Azadeh, thank you. Azadeh Mashiri, our correspondent in Nepal.
It is now 28 minutes past seven. Will they or won't they approve drilling for more gas in the North Sea? That's been the question ministers have been wrestling with for many, many months under Sir Keir Starmer's leadership and also since Andy Burnham became Prime Minister. The decision is coming. And Simon Jack can tell us, our business editor, what he's found out. Morning, Simon.
Morning, Nick. Yes. Look, there are two big oil and gas projects. One's called Rosebank, which is up near Shetland, and that's predominantly oil. And Jackdaw, which is off the east coast of Aberdeen, is 100% gas. They're two very different projects. As I say, both of those were approved under the last government. But last year, both were stopped in their tracks by a successful court challenge by climate groups who said that they'd been unlawfully approved because they hadn't assessed the full climate impact of when the oil and the gas that they produce will be burned. So the judge ruled that more detailed assessments had to be published, and that went out to consultation in July. That closed in August. And I understand that approval of Jackdaw could come as early as mid-September, not least because that's when Parliament breaks before the party conference season begins. And they're targeting that because the owners, which is basically Shell and the Norwegian company Equinor, they say that if they get an early decision by then, it could start supplying gas to the UK network by this winter. And as we were hearing from Chris O'Shea earlier in this programme today, storage levels in the UK and across Europe are very low, and it's thought that Jackdaw could produce 6% of the UK's total production when it's at full flow. That will be several years to come. Now, of course, climate groups say that millions of tons of carbon will be put into the atmosphere, equivalent to something like 60 to 90% of Scotland's emissions in a single year. That's over the lifetime of Jackdaw. But as he was saying, Prime Minister Andy Burnham recently said there needs to be a pragmatic approach, was the word he used. He said, we won't be able to stop using oil and gas for some time. That's just a fact. And then, interestingly, he said the question is whether we can accelerate the use of it so that we can pay for the transition. So that's the target. It's expected to be approved. And what I understand is the timeline, they'd like to get this done by before Wednesday, the 16th of September. So it could be in the coming days.
Simon, thank you very much indeed.
It's 7:30. Now it's time for the sport. Here's Mike.
Thank you, Anna. We're talking cricket this hour because England's women secured a comfortable series win over the Republic of Ireland yesterday, comfortably winning the second one-day international by 6 wickets at Derby. And after the match, I spoke to fast bowler Izzy Wong, who started by admitting that yesterday's win was a lot easier than the first ODI on Tuesday when England required a record run chase for victory.
Yeah, the batters really won us that last game, and I think we owed them a slightly lower chase today, and yeah, it was really good. I think we've played some really good cricket throughout the series with bat and ball in places, and really exciting thing, I guess, is that we've got one more game to hopefully put it all together.
Yes, to round off the series and indeed the summer for England. And this was a match to remember for you in Derby, wasn't it, Izzy? Your first international five-wicket haul. It must have been special for you.
Yeah, really special. It feels like, yeah, really pleasing, I guess, to be able to contribute to winning games for England, I guess. That's what you kind of dream of when you're a kid. So to tick that one off today was really nice, really pleasing.
And looking back, not just at this series, Izzy, but the summer as a whole for England, how do you assess the last few months? Obviously, there was the run all the way to the World Cup final back in the early summer, followed by the first ever women's test match at Lord's, which perhaps didn't go the way you would have wanted against India, followed by this series win over Ireland. What is your assessment of the summer?
It's been a really busy summer. I think that probably is testament to how the women's game's grown over the last few years. And I can't remember a year where we played, you know, as many games as we did this summer across all formats, really. That test match at Lord's, that was really special as well. And I think just the way the World Cup went and how it felt like the public really bought in, turned up and watched and really engaged with that. And it just, yeah, it makes me feel really happy, I guess, because it shows that the women's game's in a really good place. And, you know, that's what we all want as a dressing room. We want to make sure that young girls want to come and nick our spots, basically. So it's really pleasing, I guess, to see the position it's in.
Well, that's it, isn't it? And I guess it is only natural now to start looking ahead and planning for the future. I'm sure head coach Charlotte Edwards already has one eye on next year, which is another big one, isn't it, for England's women. It's the Champions Trophy in February over in Sri Lanka, followed by a home Ashes series next summer. I guess the best way to prepare for that is for the head coach to make sure she has the right blend of youth and experience in her team.
I think blend is the really key word there. It feels like we've had a lot of experience, but also, yeah, some new faces, like obviously Tilly coming into the squad.
This is the 18-year-old spinner, isn't it? Tilly Courtine Coleman, who's been a real breakout star for England this summer.
Yeah, she's honestly been a joy to be around. She's brought so much energy. Her perspective coming in has been really important. When times were tense, sort of during the World Cup, I think she really reminded a lot of us, like, actually, this is the place to be, and that we really enjoyed it, I think, and she was a massive part of that. It's been really cool to see people like Charlie Dean, Sophia Dunkley, Alice Capsey, really, it feels like they've taken on responsibility as well, and they've really grown into those roles. So, yeah, it's been really, really cool, so I guess, be a part of it and to watch your mates thrive, I guess.
Well, you do have one final match of the summer, don't you, this Sunday, the last ODI against Ireland. All the best for that, and then I hope you get some rest before it all starts again next year. Izzy Wong, thank you so much for speaking to us on the programme.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
Great chatting to Izzy Wong. And that final ODI of this series between England's women and Ireland is at Worcester on Sunday.
Thank you very much indeed, Mike. There'll be a heady mix of headlines and humour this evening.
Friday Night Comedy on BBC Radio 4.
Somebody's got to turn the White House Wi-Fi off after 10 p.m.
Four panellists, one week of news.
It's like finding out that the four horsemen of the apocalypse are splitting up to pursue solo careers.
With guests including Alistair Beckett-King, Rachel Fairburn and Zoe Lyons.
We have no idea what is going on because there is a bat flying around in that man's head.
The new series of The News Course with me, Andy Zaltzman, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
I'm afraid you lose a point for bringing a fact to this show.
Starting tonight at 6:30.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford, Nick Robinson at the Reform Conference in Birmingham, and at 25 to 8, Jane Steele has a summary of the news.
Downing Street says the UK's position on the Falkland Islands is unwavering and extends to the islanders' right to exploit their own natural resources, after Argentina's President Javier Milei heightened tensions. In a televised address, Mr. Milei said he would impose economic sanctions on companies which exploit oil close to the British Overseas Territory. He was speaking after Donald Trump suggested he might reconsider Washington's stance on the Falklands. Undercover filming appears to show a senior aide to Nigel Farage suggesting a way to get around electoral law to try to secure a foreign donation of £500,000 for Reform UK. Dan Dukes was filmed meeting a man posing as the British-based son of a rich American businessman. The footage was gathered by Verbatim Investigations, a group founded by journalists from the Centre for Climate Reporting and broadcast by Channel 4. Reform, which is holding its party conference in Birmingham, denies any wrongdoing. It says it's the target of a hoax perpetuated by foreign-funded climate change activists posing as would-be party donors. Emergency teams in Nepal have found two survivors who've been trapped in a tunnel since the devastating floods 9 days ago. They've been airlifted to hospital. Rescuers say they called into one of the tunnels at the Trishuli Power Project and several voices responded beyond a blocked section. BBC News understands that the government will approve a new gas field off the coast of Aberdeen as soon as this month. The Jackdaw project was first approved by the Conservative government in 2022, but environmental groups successfully challenged the decision in the courts. The US Vice President J.D. Vance has said the fighting between America and Iran is not a war and has avoided specifying when it might end. Mr. Vance said the US had ended major combat operations despite renewed attacks by both sides this week. The Environment Secretary has suggested people should stock up on food ahead of a government campaign about preparing for national emergencies. Dame Angela Eagle said that events such as the weather pattern El Niño needed to be taken seriously.
Jane, thank you. It's now 23 minutes to eight. Not so long ago, many started to think the previously unthinkable Nigel Farage could become Prime Minister. For those here in Birmingham at the Reform Party conference, that was a dream. For others, a nightmare. Yet after leading in the polls for month after month and having unprecedented success in May's elections in English councils and the Scottish and Welsh Parliament, things began to go wrong. The party started to lose crucial by-election. It slipped in the polls and now faces yet more allegations about where it gets its money from. When the Reform leader comes on stage to give his big leader's speech, he knows he's got a mighty big job to do to get back on track. Nigel Farage, the great showman of British politics, hoped this week to stage something of a political comeback, to prove that he'd put a bloody, a bruising, an angry summer behind him, to show that in line with the tune the trumpeters were rehearsing here on the set last night, he is the champion of the common man. His message, the one you see everywhere here in Birmingham, is they're preparing for their first 100 days in power. But here at the Reform Conference, talking to business leaders, Danny Kruger, defector from the Tory party, policy guru. Is that your official title?
The title is Head of Preparation for Government, Nick.
And that is what this conference, you want it to be seen to be about?
When we go into government, we will do it with a thick manifesto, a clear programme of power, and the public will have every right to expect that it's going to actually happen.
A turbulent past few months has led some to wonder whether the Reform souffle might just be collapsing, whether angry voters might now be looking around for rather more solid fare. Luke Trill studies public opinion. He's director of the polling company More in Common.
I think what a lot of people miss is that particularly if you look at Conservative Reform waverers, those people who essentially will decide whether Reform can leapfrog the Conservatives permanently or the Conservatives remain the main force on the right, are actually quite transactional. They are most motivated by who can defeat the Labour Party. They want to see a right-leaning government in office. The polls in themselves matter. They influence this group of voters because they're so motivated by getting Labour out of office and getting a more right-leaning Prime Minister in.
This party is desperate to change the subject from the one those irritating folk in the media will insist on asking about, where the party gets its money from, and why Mr. Farage accepted a £5 million personal donation from a foreign-based cryptocurrency billionaire.
Yeah. Is it a gift, a reward, or is it for your security?
Because no, it's an unconditional gift. I can spend it on Ferraris if I wish to.
But will you give the money back?
What on earth has that got to do with you? If I did, it would be a purely private matter, as the money was in the first place.
Well, you could say no, but it sounds to me like you're saying you might give it back.
I don't think it's any of your business, frankly.
But still, the questions keep on coming. Last night, Channel 4 News aired this recording by an undercover team posing as a wealthy American and his son, who's based in the UK.
Can we just order food?
Yeah.
Oysters, please. Oysters, please. Should we do four each?
I'll have half a dozen, please.
That's amazing.
Cheers.
Lunch over champagne and oysters followed the offer to Mr. Farage's aides of a £500,000 donation. The donor was to be the son, based in the UK, but the money would be given to him by his father, who's resident in the United States, and therefore not a permissible donor.
All above board, I'm going to be the... It'll be me, so it'll be, I'll be the registered donor. I think there'll be some conversations, you know, necessarily, you know, lawyers, back office and so on. But then Dad will send the money to me, and then as soon as that's done, all of those conversations are had, then the money's available.
The donation was never made. Reform UK deny any wrongdoing, but a series of allegations have had an impact where it matters.
Flashback to this time last year, Reform really were riding high in the polls.
Luke Trill again.
And with a divided opposition, that could have been enough to see Nigel Farage end up in Downing Street. In our focus groups, we were getting a certain degree of excitement about the idea of Reform, this idea that it would be something different, that Nigel Farage was the vehicle for this change.
But
fast forward to today, Reform are no longer on that peak. Andy Burnham has moved the Labour Party into the lead. The Conservatives have stabilised. And a series of episodes just seem to have made some of those wavering Reform voters go, oh, I'm not quite sure.
And it's not just the waverers who are a problem. Nigel Farage now faces a challenge on the right. Rupert Lowe, once a Reform UK MP, is now Nigel Farage's bitter enemy and the leader of a new party, Restore Britain, which has the backing of the world's richest man, Elon Musk. Sometimes Mr. Farage claims not to care. Sometimes he says something rather different.
You could see a situation where Restore, without the hope of winning anything outside Great Yarmouth, I mean, literally without a hope of winning a single seat in the country, could do us great harm.
Luke Trill again.
Reform now finds itself somewhat ironically in the pincer movement that the two traditional main parties have found themselves in. The emergence of Restore on their right is actually taking the group that Reform should have in the bank, you'd see as their base. Some of them reject the boundaries that Nigel Farage has traditionally put around ethno-nationalism, refusing to allow figures like Tommy Robinson into Reform. They want Restore's more boundaryless version of right-wing politics. And that poses a problem because chase after those who have the views which are out of step with the vast majority of the public, and you lose voters the other way. But equally, you can't afford to let your right flank become an issue.
And that pincer movement is fueling painful splits inside this party. Tim Montgomery, once a prominent Conservative, was one of a series of prominent defectors to Reform UK. Now he finds himself barred from this conference for warning that his new party is turning off those it most needs to appeal to. He blames his banning on Reform UK's Mr. Angry, Zia Youssef, who recently accused a former defence secretary of being a traitor to his country.
It's easier to understand Zia Youssef's actions if you think that his main motivation is to succeed Nigel Farage as leader of the party. Everything he says and does seems to me much more to be about currying favour with the hardcore Reform voter than the kind of floating voter Reform needs to be a majority party.
It's business day. The conference hasn't started. There's a real effort, is there, by Reform to reach out to business?
Yeah, they're more business people than they are politicians, and that's what we need. We need people that have run businesses, talking our language.
Why are you here?
I'm interested to hear and see how the party is developing. They may well be in government. We need to understand what they will do.
Is that a change for you?
Yes, I think it's a change for everybody. I mean, 5 years ago, there was no prospect.
But what will business, what will others make of the promise Nigel Farage is set to make today to declare a national state of emergency on his first day in power and to take on the judges, civil servants, members of the House of Lords who, he says, get in our way. I put it to Policy Chief Danny Kruger that that all sounds rather like Donald Trump.
The public are deeply fed up with the way that the system we have at the moment stops necessary things happening. Stopping the illegal immigration crisis, whether it's introducing measures to reduce the cost of energy, stopping crime in our streets. In all of these areas, we need to take robust action. And that will involve a challenge to the status quo.
You've been inspired, haven't you, by what Trump has achieved in his second term?
Well, listen, we're a different country and we have a different style, but the challenge across the West is similar. It's an established set of powers in the system, in the judiciary, in Parliament, in the executive branch of government, who observe alternative sources of authority than the democratic elected government. And that's what we want to change. And that is going to involve some
revolution.
A restoration.
That's what you want. You want to tear up the House of Lords, tear up the judiciary, sack half of the civil service and say, we've been elected, we get our own way without anybody standing in our way.
Nick, I think you know that that isn't the case. What we want to do is to bring back a model of government that responds to the actual directly elected will of the people, not a model of elite power unaccountable to the public.
So here, old friend and colleague of Nigel Farage in the battle for Brexit, Aaron Banks.
Hello, Nick. Fancy meeting you here.
Is there just the faintest possibility that the bad boys of Brexit, as you called yourselves, are having to get serious?
I agree with that. I mean, it's a process of change, isn't it? I mean, we're only 18 months old. The media would have, you know, written us off already. But, I mean, we've only been going 18 months, right?
Some people think you're finished because Nigel can't resist taking a big fat check from some rich friends.
I think you're out of date, Nick. It's cryptocurrency. That's not check.
Does that make it better?
I'm just joking with you, obviously.
At that point in our conversation, Nigel Farage's old friend remembered what he was meant to say. The test of this week is which version of Reform UK the common man will hear. The bad boys of Brexit who break the rules and insist that nobody cares, or the man with a plan to produce the change so many have wanted for so long.
Well, just in the last few minutes, Reform UK have told the BBC that Dan Jukes, an aide to Nigel Farage, and the party's head of policy, James Orr, have stepped down. Nick, everything that you were saying there, all of those voices that we were hearing, this is not the conversation that they wanted everybody to be having this morning.
Not the conversation they were even having last night as we were processing that story. Instantly, Reform said, it's all a hoax, this undercover filming, and they said it was a hoax by effectively their political enemies. Then they said they were having an investigation this morning after the Labour Party said that they were reporting it to the Metropolitan Police. Reform UK have now confirmed that story to the BBC, saying that following the broadcast of a Channel 4 news programme, both individuals have stepped down from their respective positions pending, crucial word, Anna, pending the outcome of the investigation. So in other words, they're saying that these two key aides, a man who's trying to put the policy meat on the bones of what Nigel Farage stands for, James Orr, and Dan Jukes, a man who's been at his side for many, many years, are stepping down for now. When we speak to the leader, deputy leader of the party at 8:10, we might ask him just what he's waiting for before they stand down permanently.
Yes, some interesting questions to ask. You'll hear them at 8:10 on the programme. And in a few minutes as well, why have formal complaints about new homes tripled just in the last year? We will ask the head of the New Homes Ombudsman Service about the growing scourge of leaky taps and dodgy floors that they're having to deal with. Before that, though, it's time for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning is Akandadi Das, a Vaishnav Hindu teacher and theologian.
Good morning. London offered a new experience yesterday, the chance to book a ride in an Uber robo-taxi. I don't much like driving in London traffic, so it seems astounding we have engineered a machine to navigate its unpredictable streets. Albeit that for now, there will be a human safety driver on hand if needed. long before the infernal combustion engine. Sri Krishna, whose appearance some 5,000 years ago has been celebrated today, explained how the soul is being carried within and activates the machine of the body. The soul, in Vedic terms, is not something we have, it is what we are. That aspect of ourself that is conscious, aware we're alive. But the soul, or Atma as it is termed, is described as a passenger, not the actual driver. So the concept of a passenger in a robo-taxi is even more apropos. Many of us may feel a certain disquiet about autonomous vehicles. No doubt they will develop to be as safe or safer than human drivers. But what if there is a collision, an injury? Who is accountable when humans are taken out of the loop? After all, we believe we are agents of free will who should be responsible for our actions and mistakes. But how much of our free will do we use? Are our thoughts, choices and behaviour more influenced and conditioned than we realise? The Katha Upanishad explores these questions by describing a chariot representing our physical body being drawn by five tempestuous horses. These horses epitomise our impetus and desires for security, safety and enjoyment in this world. Left to themselves, these wild horses will charge in all directions with ourselves as an unfortunate passenger being tossed around at the back. The demands of the mind are like the horses who must be controlled by reins held by the chariot driver. This driver represents the discriminative faculty of discernment and prudence. But, warns the Upanishad, it is up to the Atma passenger how much leeway it gives to their chariot driver. The Vedic conclusion is that we probably exercise far less free will than we think we do, because we delegate too many unsupervised decisions to autonomous mental processes, allowing them to determine the journey of our lives. However, paradoxically, we also have far more free will than we think we have. That's because we could be much more proactive, analysing our thoughts and motivations when deciding what is actually wise, good or beneficial. Such mindful reflection, says the Upanishad, is the formula for getting our robo-taxi life to its intended destination.
That was Thought for the Day with Akhandadi Das, a Vaishnav Hindu teacher and theologian. 7 minutes to 8 now. Leaky taps, windows that don't fit properly, uneven floors. Moving into a new build home does normally come with a few snags that need fixing. But it's becoming a real problem with defects and problems. The main reason why complaints to the New Homes Ombudsman Service have tripled in the last year. Dozens of people have contacted BBC Your Voice with stories of shoddy work and safety defects. And remember, by the time that those issues reach the ombudsman, it means that new homeowners have already tried their hardest and failed to actually get them fixed by the house builder. And of course, not all developers have become members of that scheme. Well, Claire McNaughton moved into her new house in 2023. She had various issues with it that only got resolved in April of this year, but she didn't end up going to the ombudsman.
From the very first day of moving in and having our first shower in the ensuite, I had a continuous leak into my kitchen, which I reported immediately, and it took over 2.5 years to eventually resolve. And the resolution of it, because they left it for so long and wanted to cut corners and to save money in trying to fix the problem, which I had like loads of holes cut out of my ceiling. I had loads of different plumbers coming, looking up with their phones, looking into the ceiling, looking for the leak. And they eventually left it for so long that the mold spread so badly in my ensuite bathroom that it permeated into my main bathroom. I ended up having to have both of the bathrooms completely refurbished.
Well, that was Claire's experience. Nigel Cates is the Chief Ombudsman at the New Homes Ombudsman Service. Good morning.
Good morning.
I think what Claire highlighted there is one of the big problems is these things inevitably happen when something is being built, but people are having real issues actually trying to get the developers to address it and fix it in a timely manner.
We see that far too much. It's often not the underlying issue that causes the most problems. It is the developer's response to it and the customer having to chase repeatedly for clear answers for a durable repair. Customers can feel ignored and not believed when they raise their concerns.
How do you, as the Ombudsman, change that? Do you have the power to go straight to a company and say, fix this now?
So when the customer brings a complaint to us, we look to resolve it as the sort of easiest, quickest way that we can, which is often by agreement with the developers. And the majority of our complaints are resolved that way. The developers that have signed up to us are the developers that have chosen the higher standards. They welcome the independent scrutiny of the Ombudsman Service. And obviously that's the best outcome. But yes, we have binding powers. If the parties don't agree, we have binding powers to impose a solution, which can be to require the developer to fix the problem, redo work, finish a build properly. And it can also include compensation. And then as an Ombudsman Service, we also have a wider strategic aim to feed back to the industry, to help the, companies learn, help solve problems before they happen in the first place.
One issue that you highlighted in the middle of that answer there was that not all developers have signed up to this. The ones that haven't, how do we deal with that? Because one of the asks is for this to become a compulsory, essentially, in law. And the government have said, well, we'll look at it when there's parliamentary time, but we don't know when that might be. So what happens in the meantime?
So, I mean, I think it's a critical point. So, as I said, the developers that have signed up are the ones that have chosen higher standards. They're trying to do the right thing. They won't always get it right, but they are absolutely, their intention is right, and they are putting the resources and their efforts into learning and fixing problems. Clearly, the ones who haven't, which is around 30% of homes that are built at the moment, some of those may be great companies, but many of them will be companies that don't want the higher scrutiny.
That's important for them to for them to do that. Nigel Cates, thank you for your time this morning, Chief Ombudsman at the New Homes Ombudsman Service.
Thank you.
Time to hear from Alex Forsyth, who can tell us all about tonight's Any Questions.
Hello, good morning, Nick. Tonight we are in the Lancastrian town of Bury, which sits in the Greater Manchester region, which you might have heard a thing or two about since Andy Burnham became Prime Minister. So, whether it is domestic politics or international affairs, we have a panel poised for what might crop up. Josh McAllister is the Minister for Children and Families. Afra Brandreth is the newly appointed Shadow Environment Minister. Hannah Spencer is the Green Party spokesperson on education, business, housing and culture. And David Blair is the Telegraph's Chief Foreign Affairs commentator. We'll be live at 8 p.m. Hope you can join us.
Thank you, Alex. Now let's check the weather. Here's Sarah Keith-Lucas. Morning.
Good morning to you, Anna. Well, it's been quite a warm start to the day in the far south, but things are turning fresher across the board today as a weather front pushes its way south, and things are going to be breezy with some showers around as well. Now, for England and Wales, we've got a line of fairly heavy rain at the moment stretching from the Bristol Channel up towards the Wash. That's a weather front. As it pushes its way south, it'll become increasingly light and patchy. So just patchy outbreaks of rain the next few hours pushing across parts of southern England. The rest of England and Wales will brighten up into the afternoon with sunny spells, just one or two showers, but you will notice the strength of the wind and temperatures around 20 to 23 here. For Scotland and for Northern Ireland, cloud is clearing away from the south now, so sunny spells and showers. The showers are going to be quite frequent and heavy today across the western half of Scotland, the odd thunderstorm in. Further south and east across Scotland and Northern Ireland, fewer showers here, but it will be windy with gusts 40 to 50 miles an hour in the north and temperatures generally in the high teens. Higher pressure builds, bringing us a mostly dry day tomorrow.
Sarah, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Today with Anna Foster in Salford and Nick Robinson at the Reform UK conference in Birmingham. Good morning. It is 8 o'clock on Friday, the 4th of September. The headlines this morning. Downing Street has insisted the Falkland Islanders have a right to exploit their own resources after Argentina raised tensions with the UK by saying it would impose sanctions on oil firms in the area. Reform UK has told the BBC the senior aide to Nigel Farage has stood down after undercover filming broadcast by Channel 4 appeared to show him suggesting a way to get around electoral law. The party's head of policy has also gone. Reform UK denies wrongdoing. We'll hear from their deputy leader after this news bulletin. And two survivors have been rescued from a tunnel in Nepal 9 days after the flooding disaster, which devastated the border area with Tibet.
Also in this hour of the programme, how do we make our food supply more resistant to extreme weather? And the legendary British animation studio behind Wallace and Gromit turns 50. We will speak to one of the founders of Aardman Animations. The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
Downing Street says the UK's position on the Falkland Islands is unwavering and extends to the islanders' right to exploit their own natural resources, after Argentina's President Javier Milei heightened tensions. In a televised address, Mr. Milei said he would impose economic sanctions on companies which exploit oil close to the British Overseas Territory. In 1982, a UK task force pushed out Argentina's military when it invaded the islands in the 1982 war. Donald Trump had suggested he might reconsider Washington's stance on the Falklands, and Mr. Milei remarked that the winds of change were favouring Argentina's claim. He said any production by a British-Israeli venture at the Sea Lion oilfield, around 130 miles from the Falklands, represented a clear danger. Our correspondent Will Grant reports.
President Milei announced his sanctions plan surrounded by his cabinet at the presidential palace. The Falklands are Argentine, he said. However, the crux was a plan to introduce a bill to Parliament to impose sanctions on energy firms planning to begin oil exploration off the Falklands. Today, our national cause faces a clear and urgent danger and demands a proportional response, he said. Two oil companies, one Israeli and one British, are due to begin exploration work in the Sea Lion oil field off the Falklands coast within 2 years, something Mr. Milei said Argentina could not allow. The UK government has always insisted the Falkland Islanders are British, with a right to determine their own future.
Lord MacDonald ran the Foreign Office from 2015 to 2020. He no longer speaks for the government. He told us that the small number of islanders don't need to be given so much influence more than 4 decades after the Falklands War.
They have no incentive ever to change their minds, even though it's costing the Brits about £500 million per year. So I think this absolute lock that they have is something that needs to be looked at again. And the geography needs to be looked at again. As President Trump says, this is a group of islands a long, long way from the United Kingdom.
In the past hour, Reform UK has told the BBC that two leading figures in the party have stepped down after Channel 4 broadcast secretly recorded film of them apparently trying to secure financial contributions from someone they believed to be a foreign donor. Electoral law prohibits UK parties from receiving funding from people who can't vote here. Earlier, Reform UK insisted it had been the victim of a hoax and done nothing wrong. But this morning it said that an aide to Nigel Farage, Dan Dukes, and the party's head of policy, James Orr, had left their posts. Here's our political correspondent, Joe Pike.
Dan Dukes, a close aide to Nigel Farage, and the party's head of policy, James Orr, have now left their roles in the Reform leaders' inner circle. Mr. Dukes was filmed meeting a man posing as the British-based son of a rich American. Under UK electoral law, only those registered to vote here or companies registered here can donate to political parties. The undercover reporter tells Mr. Dukes of his concern that because of this, his father wouldn't be able to directly donate to Reform. Mr. Dukes appeared to suggest the donation could be made by the son, although the funds would have been made available to him from his father. The undercover filming was done by a US group called Verbatim Investigations, which was founded by journalists from the Centre for Climate Reporting. A Reform UK spokesman has said it's launched an investigation, but the party has been the target of a hoax perpetuated by foreign-funded climate change activists. They deny any wrongdoing. Dan Dukes and James Orr have been approached for comment.
Emergency teams in Nepal have rescued two survivors who've been trapped in a tunnel since the devastating floods 9 days ago. Officials say they expected at least 39 people will be pulled alive out of the Trishuli 3A tunnel. Our South Asia correspondent Azadeh Mashiri reports from one of the worst affected areas, the district of Rasuwa.
Amid all the devastation, this is a moment of hope. Rescuers suddenly heard voices in the Trishuli 3A tunnel more than a week after the flood that has devastated border areas. Rescuers made their way through flooded tunnels choked with mud and debris. The crew had previously blasted a hole in the crown of the tunnel and had descended on ropes. Excavators have also been used and oxygen is being pumped in. The survivors are now being airlifted to army hospitals for treatment, and the hope is more will follow.
BBC News understands that the government will approve a new gas field off the coast of Aberdeen as soon as this month. The Jackdaw project was first approved by the Conservative government in 2022, but environmental groups successfully challenged the decision in the courts, arguing that officials had not given enough consideration to the impact of burning the fossil fuels. The boss of the British gas owner Centrica, Chris O'Shea, told us a new gas field would reduce the UK's reliance on imported supplies, and it would have other benefits too.
Basic economics would tell you that if you've got a fixed demand for a product and you increase the supply, the price should move. But it wouldn't be a material movement in price in the UK. But remember that the government taxes North Sea oil and gas production at 78%. So whilst it may not move the UK consumer bills materially, it does give the government a lot of revenue, and it's up to the government to choose what it does with that revenue.
The German car group Volkswagen has announced it will cut a further 50,000 jobs worldwide by the end of the decade as it undergoes a radical restructuring. It brings the total number of planned layoffs to 100,000, the largest in automotive history. The Environment Secretary has suggested people should stock up on food ahead of a government campaign about preparing for future national emergencies. Dame Angela Eagle said that events such as El Niño, the weather pattern which can increase the risk of droughts and floods around the world, needed to be taken seriously. Here's our political correspondent Jack Fenwick.
Dame Angela Eagle, the new Environment Secretary, will oversee the building of the country's first new reservoir since 1992, as well as changes to farming, which ministers hope will make the UK more adaptable to a changing climate. She said the naturally occurring El Niño weather phenomenon could lead to drier summers, wetter winters and more extreme storms in the UK. In the coming months, the Cabinet Office will launch a campaign on preparing for emergencies. Dame Angela told The Guardian newspaper that households would be a lot better off if they stocked up on things like canned food and urged people to take steps to ensure they were more resilient.
A body set up to help resolve problems with new homes says the number of complaints it has received has more than tripled in a year. The New Homes Ombudsman Service is urging the government to make it compulsory for developers to join, something ministers say they're committed to doing. Dozens of people have also contacted BBC Your Voice with complaints about shoddy work and safety defects in their homes. Our housing correspondent Tara Welsh reports.
It's been 4 years since new building safety laws were introduced. One of the promises was that a new homes ombudsman would be compulsory, giving buyers an independent route to redress when things went wrong. But developers still aren't legally required to sign up, and around a third of new home buyers aren't protected under the current scheme. The increase in complaints partly reflects more homeowners being eligible to use the service. The Home Builders Federation says most buyers are satisfied with their homes, and some developers have yet to join the scheme because of the cost.
Researchers at Edinburgh University have warned about the use of AI to record and produce written notes of consultations between doctors and patients. 40% of GPs in the UK have used the technology, which reduces admin work for staff. But it can fail to capture the patient's experience and miss out crucial information. Here's Richard Forbes.
The researchers reviewed 27 articles about the introduction of these AI scribes. They found that the summaries produced placed too much focus on clinical information rather than capturing the patient's experience of their illness. Vital information was also being missed because non-verbal communication, such as facial expressions and gestures, weren't captured. The academics recommended that more work is done to examine the risks associated with using this type of technology in a medical setting.
The creators of Wallace and Gromit, Shaun the Sheep and Morph are auctioning some of their puppets to celebrate their 50th anniversary. Aardman Animations started with two school friends experimenting on a kitchen table and grew into an Oscar and BAFTA-winning animation studio. John Maguire reports.
Inspired by the humour of comedians such as Spike Milligan and Michael Benteen, Sir Peter Lord and Sir David Sproxton started making short, stop-frame animated films. And one of their characters, an accident-prone little plasticine man called Morph, became a star. They were paid £25. Later, Aardman recruited Nick Park, and through his creations, Wallace and Gromit, they won 3 of their 4 Oscars.
It's the wrong trousers.
To celebrate their golden jubilee, the company's auctioning off items from its archives to raise money to train the next generation of animators.
John Maguire reporting.
Thank you, Jane. It's 8:10. What a difference a day makes. Just a few hours ago, Reform UK was complaining they'd been the target of a hoax. A hoax, they said, which was perpetuated by those they described as foreign-funded climate change activists. This morning, though, they've said that two key aides to Nigel Farage, aides filmed by undercover reporters discussing channeling what is alleged would have been an illegal foreign donation to the party through a British voter, have been suspended. Suspended pending an investigation. Reform have been saying this morning that their legal advice is that no laws have been broken. Well, what this is all really about is not a super complex story. It's a rather simple one. It's about donations to the party from the super wealthy.
Do we just order food?
Yeah.
Hostess, please. Hostess, please. Should we do four each?
I'll have half a dozen.
That's
amazing.
Cheers.
Last night, Channel 4 News broadcast undercover footage from an oysters and champagne lunch in Clacton in Essex, at which Nigel Farage and a close aide, a friend of his, Dan Jukes, appear to meet with an American, a man who wants to give the party £500,000, and with his son, who, crucially, is based here in Britain. Now, in reality, he's a reporter. A reporter with something called Verbatim Investigations, founded by journalists from the Centre for Climate Reporting. The American is an actor posing as his American father. They tell Farage that they've been in discussion with his aide, with Jukes, who's at the lunch, and with another crucial man, Reform's head of policy, James Orr. They've been in discussion about a donation, which would come from the American, but be transferred to Reform UK via his UK-based son. As you'll hear, Nigel Farage tells them that, as far as he can tell, it's all above board. He thanks them.
The mechanism now for this next phase is we've had some discussions with Dan, with James.
Yeah, it's all above board. Yeah.
All above board. I'm going to be the... It'll be me. So it'll be, I'll be the registered donor. And so I think there'll be some conversations, necessarily... You know, lawyers, back office, and so on. But then Dad will send the money to me, and then as soon as that's done, all of those conversations are had, then the money's available.
Thank you, both of you. Nigel Farage says the Labour Party wrote to the Metropolitan Police this morning asking it to look into what the party say are allegations that it claims are sufficiently serious to warrant investigation against Reform UK. And earlier, you may have heard my conversation with the former head of the Electoral Commission, Bob Posner. I asked him if Reform UK knew, and of course we don't know, that's a question now for the police, that in reality a political donation was coming from abroad, would that be potentially a breach of the law?
It would be a breach of the law, and these are criminal offences we're talking about. They're serious matters, and there is a specific criminal offence which is around attempting to evade the law, taking steps to knowingly engage in further impermissible donations. So in addition to breaching the law about permissibility, there is the potential of a very serious criminal offence of trying to evade the law.
Well, with me in our appropriately rather cramped and hot, very hot studio at the Reform UK conference is the party's deputy leader, Richard Tice, and alongside him, Chris Mason, our political editor. Morning to you both.
Good morning. Morning.
Richard, we'll come to you in just a second. Chris, people who want to understand the detail can watch this footage for themselves. They can look at the detailed writing up on the BBC website as well. What does it tell us, though, about the problem this party is facing here in Birmingham?
It tells us, Nick, about the backdrop that Reform was already facing. And it's worth just rewinding 12 months to the gathering here a year ago for Reform, where they were something of a runaway insurgency. In recent months, and this was already the case, there was a backdrop of questions about money for Reform. That was the case coming into this conference, even before Channel 4 News' endeavours. Now they swirl and dominate, and they swirl and dominate, Nick, on the very morning of Nigel Farage's big address later, where he wanted to talk about a national emergency, as he describes it, that he would declare on becoming Prime Minister, where Mr Tice, the deputy leader, wants to talk about energy bills. And as is so often the case in moments like this, the opportunity cost of a swirl of headlines like the ones we're talking about, is there's much less space to talk about what the party themselves would want to talk about.
Well, let's turn for now to Richard Tice. Welcome once again, Mr. Tice. We know what you want to talk about, and let's hope if we can get through the questions about this donation, we'll still have time to do that too. What has changed? Last night, it's all the terrible hopes by your political enemies. This morning, you seem to have suspended two crucial allies to Nigel Farage.
And the two things, good morning, are true, because the reality is that no money has been received. You said it simple. Yes, it is simple. No money has been received whatsoever. We've got a KC's opinion that makes it very clear no rules have been broken. And crucially, you talk about the issue of the Elections Act. Section 61 confirms that actually the offence of entrapment, which has taken place by Channel 4 and these far-left eco-zealot radicals, who've been previously reprimanded by a US Congress report for a similar activity in the US.
Well, something they strongly refute, Richard Tice.
But the reality
is... It's a defamatory allegation. Let's not repeat it.
The reality is that no rules have been broken. Okay. I believe Channel 4 have broken the rules of entrapment. They've got questions to answer. Why do they spend hundreds of thousands of taxpayers' cash?
Let's not talk about them. Let's talk about you. No, you're the spokesman for Reform UK.
Absolutely, and that's what I'm doing. I'm just setting the context.
And you've done something very important today. You've suspended two crucial figures, and you've suspended an investigation. People listening want to understand why. What it is you know.
Because
I'll ask you the question, if I may. So when you say the advice is that you haven't broken the law, is that because nothing was ever discussed that suggested getting round the law, or is it what you might call the lawyer's defence? Lots of discussions were had about maybe breaking the law, about considering breaking the law, about taking a foreign donation and presenting it as if it was a British one. But since the money wasn't actually handed over, the law wasn't broken.
Let's go back to what you originally said. It's actually very simple. No money's been received. No benefit in kind was received. No rules have been broken. Channel 4 have broken the rules based on the KC advice.
What's the answer to the question?
The answer to the question is, of course, look, Two individuals have been suspended pending an internal investigation. All of these things can be true at the same time, and we'll have an internal investigation. Frankly, that will take however long it takes. I'm obviously not involved in that. There'll be a disciplinary process, as you would expect, and the results of that will be in due course.
Presumably, there's something serious enough to suspend two crucial people, and I'm trying to work out what it is that you're worried about. What are you so concerned about that you take the man who's in charge of the policy you're unveiling here?
I'm not concerned at all.
Are you not worried?
No, because
so they can
I know.
Come back,
what I'm worried about is why Channel 4 have broken the law.
Don't repeat the stuff about Channel 4, Mr. Tice. I'm sorry, we're talking about your party. Yes. You want to be in government, right?
And we're going to
talk about the policies later on. Could these guys come back after the investigation?
Well, let's wait and see what the investigation is. That will take its course. All right, we're pushing on.
That's quite interesting, because your party chairman has told the BBC this morning on air that they're not coming back, Lee Anderson.
Let's wait and see. It's not actually, in the nicest way, for any individual to make that determination until the investigation. We're pushing on. We've got a great conference. We've got thousands of people coming here today. We had hundreds and hundreds, I think over 1,000 business delegates yesterday. I talked about my policies to get to rebuild our town centres, rebuild council homes. Today I'm talking about how we're going to take £250 of everybody's annual household energy bill.
This is
the crucial thing that people are concerned about.
Let's
the
come
cost
to that
of living.
In just 2 seconds. The reason this matters, and the reason you know it matters, and the reason your party suspended these people, is you have to establish that you're a competent enough party.
Correct.
That your leader has the judgment to be Prime Minister. Now, are you saying that despite sitting there at that lunch with an American who turns out to be, as you put it, a fraud,
carrying out a deliberate deception in breach of Section 61
Nigel
of the
Farage
rules.
Knew nothing about the fact that he was going to give American money to your party in breach of the law?
We'll see what the investigation says.
Oh, you need to investigate when the Nigel Farage knew about the breach of the law.
We're very clear. The two individuals, we'll look at an internal investigation.
What about Nigel Farage, I'm asking about?
And in that clip that you just played...
What did he know?
Nigel said, it needs to be all above the law. That's the key thing. And that's what you say. And that is obviously the case.
He didn't say it needs to be above board. He said it was above board.
Obviously, everything has to be above board.
Okay.
That's why we check these things. That's why, as a government in waiting, This whole theme of this conference is 100 days of a Reform UK government. You know, we check the rules with our KCs, which we've done. Equally, we carry out an internal investigation. We do all these things at the same time. They can all be true and proper.
One last
and
our one, policies, then let's talk about your policies.
Our policies are the most important thing that your good listeners want to hear about.
I hear you say that everything will be true at the same time. But either discussing taking a foreign donation is bad behaviour, a potential breach of the law, and these guys should have nothing to do with your
party. And that's what the investigation's for. It's
very
simple, Nick.
Ah, right. OK. So we'll hear later about that. Interesting that the party chairman this morning says they're not coming back. Now, your big theme, as you say,
yes,
is, and it says it everywhere here, doesn't it?
The first 100 days.
Yes. Let me ask you about a specific, though. Nigel Farage, we're told, says, or is going to say this afternoon, that he would declare a state of national emergency on coming to power. And he goes on to say, if the Lords, the judges, the civil service get in our way, they will discover just how determined they are. So that's a threat.
It's just a question of reality. If we're elected as a majority government and parts of the established try to frustrate things, then we will work harder and faster with more determination, roll our sleeves up, get stuck in, and people need to understand. The country is broken, Nick. Britain is broken. Nothing's working. The economy is broken. The bond markets are applying a moron premium to the cost of UK government debt. We are heading towards bankruptcy. I've been talking about it for a year. I'm deeply concerned about it, as is Nigel and Robert Jenner.
Is Donald Trump your model for this? Because you...
It's got nothing to do with it, Nick. This is the United Kingdom.
Because you tweeted... Oh, that's very interesting, Mr. Twice, because on January the 20th last year, you didn't think that. Nick. Super Trump, says Richard Tice in a tweet. He declares, you said, a national energy emergency. Sounds familiar, rather similar to what you're suggesting, to drill, baby, drill.
Yes, and we need to drill, Britain, drill, absolutely.
So
I told
you're
the Prime
playing
Minister,
from Donald Trump's
nonsense.
Playbook.
I am Richard Tice, and I challenged the Prime Minister on Tuesday to drill, Britain, drill, to grant the licences at Jackdaw and Rosebank as elsewhere, because clearly we should be using our own energy treasure offshore, onshore. It'll bring the bills down. That's what I'm talking about. That's what people are most concerned about, the size of why the bills are going up, why Ofgem's price cap on energy is going up 4% in October, forecast another 13% in January.
Understood. What will you do to these judges? So a judge doesn't behave as you like during this period of national emergency. What do you do to the judges?
We've just got to pass the laws.
What
in
do
order
you do to
to
the judges,
Nick,
Mr. Tice?
It's very simple. Through Parliament, we will work harder, we'll pass the laws.
What does that mean?
It's very simple. You know exactly what it means.
I don't.
You pass laws to get stuff done. Right? So if we want to repeal the Human Rights Act, we pass a law. And we do it quickly and promptly because the British people want this done. They are sick and tired.
You've announced that already, but you're saying
exactly
something different. You're saying if the judiciary get in the way. I want to know what you do to the judiciary that gets in the way. What do you do to an official that you think gets in the way? Consistent with democracy.
Ensure that the rules that you pass in Parliament are enacted by Parliament and by ministers and their departments and the civil service, because people are sick and tired of politicians that say one thing and then actually don't deliver on their promises, like the Labour Party haven't delivered on the £300 reduction in their energy bills, which they promised.
One last one. Why be so nervous about saying what you really think? You know it and I know it.
I'm not nervous.
I haven't finished the question yet. You admire the way in which Donald Trump, in his second term, came to power, prepared to deal with all these people that you and he think are a great blob trying to stop governments like the one you hope to form doing what they want. And you want to learn from him. You want to say, if the judges take us on, we'll get rid of the judges. If the officials take us on, we'll get rid of the officials. That's what you think.
And Tony Blair was furious with the blob getting in his way, as was David Cameron, as was Keir Starmer. You know, these people in the establishment, they have to recognise that when voters vote for change, if they vote for a majority, then actually, and it's in the manifesto, let's get it done. Let's bring the bills down, cut the wasteful spending, cut the daft quangos that are unnecessary, get rid of the daft regulations. We'll get some growth. Happy days.
Bit of a pattern here, isn't there, Mr. Tice? When things
growth,
go wrong,
we need some growth.
Nigel Farage sacks his advisers. And now he says, if I can't get my way in government, even if I've got a majority, I'll sack the civil servants, I'll sack the judges, I'll pack the House of Lords with people who do what I want. Is that democracy?
It's absolutely democracy. If someone's been voted with a majority government, then literally the voters have said to the establishment, we want this done. Get it done.
Richard Tice, Deputy Leader of the Reform UK. Thank you very much indeed for that. Chris,
It's interesting on that last point, Nick, that Richard was making. Talking to senior reform officials, they say that the way they would seek to prosecute, if you like, that argument in the first 100 days is you've got to write a manifesto that is sufficiently tight and specific in policy that with a majority they'd be able to make the argument that says, look, there is clearly a mandate for this, and therefore perhaps mitigate against those rows with the judges or the quangos or whatever.
And when it comes to financing, there's always the danger, Chris, that you and I know the people involved, and everybody else just thinks this is a soap opera with a bunch of names I've never heard of, and I don't know why I could care. These individuals are not the guy doing the office photocopying. These are people at the heart of Nigel Farage's personal operation.
So in James Orr, you have someone whose title was head of policy, I think still is. He's the head of policy. I think that's where we're at, isn't it, Mr. Tice? And what is this conference about if it's not about unveiling policies and trying to find the bandwidth to talk about them? And Dan Jukes has been a central figure, incredibly close to Nigel Farage for years. He's the person folk like me would ring up when you're wanting to arrange an interview or find out what Mr. Farage is up to, etc., etc. Absolutely central figures.
Chris, thank you very much. Richard Tice, thank you again. Channel 4 News, incidentally, are saying they didn't pay for the polling, which is part of the controversy here, and they paid no money to those undercover investigators, verbatim, or any associated company.
It is just coming around to 27 minutes past eight now. Something notable from across the Atlantic. Do the winds of change favour the Falklands returning to Argentinian control? This is what Argentina's president, Javier Milei, has claimed in a national address overnight, flanked by his cabinet. This all happening amid rising tensions between the UK and Buenos Aires. Those winds that he talks about could be the words of US President Donald Trump, who has told GB News that he might not get involved to support the UK if Argentina decided to invade the islands. And it seems like Javier Milei is looking at ways to perhaps capitalise on that. Well, joining me in the studio here in Salford this morning is the Education Secretary, Lucy Powell. Good morning.
Good morning.
Worth saying, I think, to our listeners, I know you've been going from interview to interview this morning, so I'm going to tell you what Downing Street has said about this in the last hour or so in case you've missed it. The Falkland Islands are a British overseas territory, will remain so for as long as the islanders wish. The right of Falkland Islanders to self-determination is paramount, firmly grounded in international law. What about, though, the sanctions that Javier Milei is talking about? There's a British and Israeli company who are looking to explore that area, look for oil. He's talking about putting sanctions on that, which Downing Street's response doesn't really seem to address. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I completely agree with Downing Street's statement, and you know, been saying as much this morning myself. It's absolutely right that we say that the Falkland Islands is a British overseas territory, and it will remain one for as long as that is the wish of the Falkland Islanders. There have recently been a number of public opinion tests of that on the Falkland Islands, and it's overwhelmingly the view of those islanders, and we will defend and protect their wishes for as long as that's what they want to be the case. And I don't think it's particularly helpful for a government minister to kind of rise to the posturing of the Argentinian Prime Minister at this stage, who I think is facing an election coming up soon.
So you think it's electoral posturing? You don't think he's serious?
Well, I just want to be kind of really clear about our position about the Falkland Islands being a British overseas territory and remaining one, and we will defend the Falklanders' right to that. And I don't think it's really helpful to kind of wind the situation up in any way.
I think it's some of the issues around that are interesting. So we heard from Lord MacDonald on the programme an hour ago, and he admitted that this was not necessarily the government's position, but he was speaking as former head of the Foreign Office. He said that actually the UK should be having some negotiations, enter a conversation with the Argentinians, talk about things like, for example, sharing revenues on those oil drilling projects with Argentina. Is that something that the government should be considering? Would you rule out any kind of future oil sharing revenues, sharing of oil revenues, for example?
We're really clear about the territory themselves and you know, what the status of the territory is as a British overseas territory, and we support
the
Falkland
Islands. I think that's clear, and I think you've definitely made that clear. It's more the issues around that and the fact that he has specifically started talking about sanctions and oil overnight. So do you think there is a conversation for the government to have with Argentina about that?
Well, we have, as you would expect, you know, we have diplomatic conversations all the time on an ongoing basis with every country, including, you know, Argentina. And I don't think it's sort of helpful to these situations that we kind of start having those on the airwaves at this juncture, because I think it's important to keep the tone of that right and to minimise any kind of posturing and just be absolutely clear with our principles, our starting point, where we are at with these issues. And these are matters for our diplomatic services.
One of the complicating factors here is what President Trump had to say when he was asked about the UK and the Falklands on GB News yesterday.
This is a club that's dedicated to women. We're not sharing facilities.
That's clearly not the right clip. Do we have that clip of
this is a club
on GB News yesterday? Okay, I'm told we don't have that. But basically what he said was, and I will paraphrase in the absence of that clip, that that were Argentina to invade the Falklands, and there's no suggestion that is on the cards immediately. But what he said was that because the UK had not supported him when it came to Iran, or that was his perception of it, that he would not necessarily support the UK, support the Falklands if that were to happen. Again, it's a complicating factor. We see US foreign policy from our key close ally having a real impact, something which the British government then has to try and deal with at moments like this.
Well, I've also learned to not give a running commentary on Trump's latest pronouncements too. I mean, look, as you say, these are all very complicated issues. As a British overseas territory, you know, Falklands is part of Britain. We're part of NATO. We have these big alliances as part of NATO, of which, of course, the US is one of our key allies, but you know, the kind of all these sort of geopolitics are changing very quickly. You know, we are in kind of uncertain times in many ways, but you know, we stand steadfast as an ally, as a partner in NATO, and we will defend our own territories and continue to do that.
That brings in questions of defence as well, because there's also this story, which you will have seen, about the army being told to stop non-essential training exercises to try and save money. So if soldiers are about to be deployed, then they will still get training. But when there isn't a specific deployment in mind, then that will stop. And that would seem to be short-sighted when we're having a conversation like the one we're having this morning about the defence of the Falklands, at the same time for the army to not have the money to keep its soldiers in a state of readiness.
Well, as I say, we are in these incredibly uncertain times, and that's why we are absolutely committed to increased defence spending. It's already significantly increased since the Labour Party came into government 2 years ago. We are absolutely committed to that 3.5% defence spending by 2035.
Which is not the same one, is it, that John Healey was talking about when he was watered down a bit now.
No, not at all. And we'll set out a clear pathway to meeting that target in the spring statement next year. We are committed to the Defence Investment Plan, which is a huge, significant investment plan, which is based upon this sort of strategic defence review, looking at modern day warfare. And I think that's what's really important about this story today about training. We are seeing the battlefield and modern day warfare changing before our eyes. It's significantly different from what it was a few years ago. And that's why the nature of training and the nature of our armed forces need to change with those times. And that's what the Strategic Defence Review, the Defence Investment Plan, and all the significant investment into the defence is all about. Because we're seeing from Ukraine, aren't we, right now, the use of drones, and the battlefield has changed significantly. So I think the the type of training exercises need to change significantly with that. This is not a cost issue. This is about modern warfare.
We're going to speak in the next few minutes to your Labour colleague, Andy McDonald, the MP for Middlesbrough. There are four schools on Teesside which are closing early today. And this is because the funeral for one of the five young men in the car that was involved in the crash on the A66 is happening. Schools have been told, warned. We don't quite know exactly what's gone on in the background, but they have decided that the safest thing to do for the children at those schools is to get their parents to pick them up early. Now, it is a delicate situation. Your shadow, Laura Trott, has written to you. She said that children should not be kept out of school because of the behaviour of thugs on the streets, which is right. That's not an incorrect statement to make. But how to deal with that is the question.
Well, look, as Education Secretary, I want schools to be open. I want pupils attending schools all the time. And these head teachers of these small number of schools have taken a very difficult decision with the local authority and the police for the safety of their school community to close early. What I would say is that there are huge anxieties and worries in the communities. I spoke to one of the local MPs, Anna Turley, yesterday about this too, and I'm in touch with Home Office ministers. That's why we've put in significant surge policing, extra resources with the police to really try and calm those tensions down and to make the streets safe. I trust head teachers to make the judgments that they need to make to keep their school community safe. I hope this doesn't have to happen again, because as I say, as the Education Secretary, I want schools to be open. I want pupils to attend them. And what I would just say is I really don't think at this particular juncture we should be seeking to make party political point scoring out of this. This is a very, very difficult and delicate situation, as you say, and I will always put the safety and well-being of children at the forefront of anything I do.
One final thought. One of the things that you are here to talk about this morning is school uniforms and the fact that schools have been told from the start of this new school year that they basically can't have as many branded items mm-hmm. as they want to try and stop parents having to shell out for all of these different things. That came in a few weeks ago because we talked about it here on the programme. So parents will be sending their children back with fewer branded items now. Is there any suggestion that schools are not adhering to this the way that you want them to?
Well, it's really important that schools do bear down on the cost of uniform, because it is the biggest worry that parents face with back to school at this time of year is the cost of uniform. So that's why we've limited the number of branded items, 3 for primary schools, 3 plus a tie for secondary schools. But I want schools to really operate the spirit of that legislation as well and make sure that they're taking further steps to make the cost of those branded items lower as well by seeking more competition with suppliers and other things. And I want schools to really make sure that they are keeping the costs low. And I have further powers, if I need to use them, to make sure that schools are absolutely doing that, because we have seen some bad behaviour. We've seen some fantastic behaviour with schools giving free blazers, free ties to their school community. Other schools, you know, they have, I think, sometimes put the cost of uniform so high as to put off some parents applying. And that's not what we want to see.
And something you'll be watching, Lucy Powell, the Education Secretary. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
And coming up in a few minutes' time, we're going to hear from the MP for Middlesbrough, just talking about a town that's been described as being living in terror. But before that, Mike is here at 22 minutes tonight, a bit later than normal, with the sport.
Thank you, Nick. Shall we talk football? Because the new Women's Super League season starts this evening. The opening match sees last year's WSL surprise package. London City Lionesses host Manchester United. Now, London City are very ambitious and have made several big-name signings this summer, including former Ballon d'Or winner Alexia Putellas and the ex-England goalkeeper Mary Earps. Well, I've been reflecting on those signings with their owner, the American businesswoman Michelle Kang, the woman who has signed the cheques to pay for these new players. And she made the point that unlike every other side in the Women's Super League, London City do not have an equivalent men's club. They are the only independent side in the division.
This is a club that's dedicated to women. We're not sharing facilities. This is not a second side project. This women's team is the project. We're the only independent team. So everything we do is really 100% with our female athletes in mind. And that's a huge difference. And I think a lot of players love to see what that vision could help them really thrive. And as a player and as a team.
Some of the really big names that you have brought to the club this summer, it is probably fair to say, are not at the very peak of their career. Have you, as a lot of other sports teams often do, aimed to perhaps bring in a bit of stardust to the club to boost the team's profile at the same time?
Yeah, I mean, I think every team needs a mix. You need experienced players who would lead the team and help young players come through. And we have quite a few young players who can learn from all these experienced players.
You mentioned earlier that London City Lionesses are the WSL's only fully independent side. How proud are you of that status? And would you like to see more independent teams in the WSL?
Yeah, I absolutely would like to see more independent teams. That doesn't mean that you have to be totally independent. I'm really grateful for the decision that Sunderland made, which is that their primary focus is men's team, which is absolutely okay. But then they realize that the women's team may not get the necessary attention and resources. So they looked out and found somebody who is willing to put all the necessary investment and resources to really grow women's team. So there are multiple business models, but I think the key is that the women's teams will need to get the necessary attention, the resources, so that they can be on their own.
I wonder what you also made of recent comments by Sir Jim Ratcliffe, one of the co-owners at Manchester United, when he said that their women's team, Manchester United Women, was not a priority for him. I mean, you perhaps wonder what their growth potential would be if women's football was higher up on his list of priorities and invested in more.
I totally respect his decision, or for that matter, any other owner who feels that the men's team is a priority. That's totally okay. It's their business. But then find other people, bring them in to get the necessary attention. Women's football is not a side project. It's not a community charity project. They deserve due attention and resources. So I hope that not only Manchester United, but other teams find a way to support women's teams and make the necessary investment.
And speaking of investment, there is a significant announcement, isn't there, ahead of this new WSL season concerning London City and a landmark front of shirt deal.
Nike is London City's front of shirt sponsor, and it is really proof of the momentum behind the club. The value of our front of shirt deal is higher than some of the Premier League men's teams, the front of shirt deals. This deal reflects the growing commercial value of women's football. So for all those doubters out there, take notice. Partnerships like this show that leading companies increasingly see women's clubs not as an add-on, but as important sporting and cultural properties in their own right. The fans are coming, commercial companies are joining, and building this momentum with us. This is not a moment, this is a movement. And of course, there will be some growing pains along the way. We brought some new model to WSL, and some people think it's too disruptive, but this is happening. It's only going to go upwards.
Thanks to the London City Lionesses owner there, Michelle Kang, speaking to me ahead of the first match of the new Women's Super League season, which is London City against Manchester United this evening. Kickoff, 7 o'clock.
Yeah, some interesting things to say there. Thank you, Mike. Now, a long-running TV programme, which is turning 40, is the focus of the reunion with Kirsty Walklater.
When it began in 1986, it had a political pulse that upset the powers that be. Created by two young writers, TV medical drama Casualty set out to expose how the then government was starving Britain's National Health Service of funds. Storylines tackled hospital cuts, overworked nurses and understaffed A&E departments. It didn't take long for the government to notice, and they were not best pleased. That's the early years of Casualty in the reunion, this morning at 9 o'clock.
Thanks, Kirsty. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford, Nick Robinson at the Reform Conference in Birmingham. At 16 minutes to 9, Jane Steele's got a summary of the news.
Two leading Reform UK figures have stepped down after undercover filming for Channel 4 News appeared to show a senior aide suggesting a way to get around electoral law to try to secure a foreign donation of £500,000. Electoral law prohibits UK parties from receiving funding from people who can't vote here. Earlier, Reform UK insisted it had been the victim of a hoax and done nothing wrong. But this morning it said that an aide to Nigel Farage, Dan Dukes and the party's head of policy, James Orr, had left their posts. The party's deputy leader, Richard Tice, who's at its conference in Birmingham, told us that Reform had received no money and no rules had been broken. Reform's chairman, Lee Anderson, said there was no chance of Mr. Dukes and Mr. Orr returning to the party. They have been approached for comment. Downing Street says the UK's position on the Falkland Islands is unwavering and extends to the islanders' right to exploit their own natural resources after Argentina's president Javier Milei heightened tensions. Mr. Milei said he would impose economic sanctions on companies which exploit oil close to the Falklands. The Education Secretary, Lucy Powell, told us the Falkland Islands would retain its status as a British overseas territory for as long as those living there wanted it. And it wasn't helpful for a government minister here to rise to what she called the posturing of Argentina's president. Rescuers in Nepal have recovered two survivors from a tunnel in the area affected by a massive flash flood last week. Officials say they expect at least 39 people to be rescued.
Thank you very much indeed, Jane. It is 14 minutes to nine now. As we were discussing with the Education Secretary, Lucy Powell, just a few minutes ago, several schools close to where two police officers were killed in a crash on the A66 on Teesside are going to close early today. And this decision has been made because a funeral is taking place for one of the five people who died in the other car, which was travelling the wrong way along the road after a high-speed pursuit when those two vehicles collided. Warnings of large crowds gathering in the area, possible disruption, means that parents at four different schools have been told to collect their children before lunchtime. And this has caused really fresh anger and concern about crime and antisocial behaviour in the area and about whether it's being properly tackled. Andy McDonald joins us, the Labour MP for Middlesbrough and Thornaby East. Good morning.
Good morning, Anna.
I think, as we were saying with Lucy Powell as well, this is a difficult and delicate situation. It is a sensitive situation. At the heart of it, and what has caused some real anger here, is that children are unable, having just gone back to school a couple of days ago, are unable to do their full day at school today. And for most people, that's not an acceptable situation for them.
Well, it is disruptive and it is mightily regrettable, but in these circumstances, I think we've got to be supportive of the professional judgments of the schools themselves, supported by the magnificent Cleveland Police. So I think, you know, this is a proportionate issue. If we turn around the weekend and thought this was totally unnecessary, I'd rather be having that conversation than seeing something erupt or some sort of conflict occur that would impact upon these communities.
I think it's less about the judgment of the schools in this situation, because they will do naturally whatever they think is best and safest for the children. I think it's more about a situation in which the local area, the streets, are not under the control of the police. You know, they can't guarantee that everybody will be there in a law-abiding way. And that is the broader issue here, isn't it?
Well, you do expose a broader issue, and I've been consistent in my pleas and complaints to successive governments about the reduction in full-time equivalence officers in Cleveland. There is a chart, and it shows a 23% increase since 2010, between 2010 and 2025 for Surrey. And you go all the way down to the very, very bottom of the table, and Cleveland appears there with a 13% reduction. We have the highest crime rates in the United Kingdom, and yet we've got the lowest resources, and we do badly when it comes to settlements. That cannot be right. And I welcome the £2 million announced by Shabana Mahmood. That will help greatly towards paying for the Mutual Aid and Assistance Bill. We're grateful for the help that was received, but it really won't do anything to address the 200 officers that we need in Cleveland Police. So your point is a good one, and I entirely am consistent about that. We cannot allow these criminal gangs to career around and terrorise people in their homes and communities. And I want to be wholly supportive of the police and other agencies in getting on top of that.
There's been some focus on your use of the word terrorism to describe what's happening on the streets there. And the general understanding of that when you use the word terrorism is that there's some sort of underpinning ideology in what's going on, some ideological reason for people to be carrying out that behaviour. Is that what you were referring to? Do you think there is an ideology at work here? Or is it just a... Would you change that term if you were to use it again, for example? I see what you were trying to say with it, but I think my question is, was that the right word?
Yeah, let me be clear. Look, we have pockets of disorder and pockets of normality. The majority of people, as you know, Anna, go around about their daily lives without any impingement or interference whatsoever. But there are certain places where people's lives, they're living in terror. They are terrorised. And, you know, terrorism is the calculated use of violence and intimidation against civilians for intended aims. Their aims are lawlessness and exploitation and criminality. I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole, but, you know, if your nana can't get to the shops to buy a pint of milk because she's terrified of stepping foot outside the house, you've got to recognise that. And it's a damn sight nearer terrorism than an 80-year-old retired cleric protesting in Trafalgar Square in her Zimmer frame, and being brought within the orbit of terrorism. Our values are getting skewed here. We want people to be able to lead decent, peaceful lives, and that should be the guarantee. It isn't available to some people and a minority of communities, and I want that to change.
Andy McDonald, the Labour MP for Middlesbrough and Thornaby East, thank you.
It's 9 minutes to 9 now. If your mind needs a little therapy after a diet of some quite heavy news that we've had, stay tuned, because we're going to be talking about Wallace and Gromit and Shaun the Sheep and Morph indeed. Or after the programme's over on Radio 3 Breakfast, Tom McKinney will whisk you into a world of masked balls and Italian choreography with 4A's delightfully happy sweet Mask a Burger Masks. Helpfully, he's told me how to pronounce that, but only after I've already said it on the radio. Hopefully, I did get it right. Well, let's turn now to the wonderful Morph, Wallace, Gromit, Chicken Run, Shaun the Sheep. Yes, all the creations of Aardman Animations. They have inspired not just children, but an awful lot of adults. Now, you should always declare an interest before doing an interview, so it's important before I talk to the man who helped to create Aardman Animations that I declare that I was recently given by my daughter, a fridge magnet of Wallace and a slice of Wensleydale cheese. That reflects my obsession with Aardman's creations. So Peter Lord joins us this morning. Morning to you, Peter.
Good morning. Hello.
And I hear that we are also joined briefly, by a certain Morph.
He is... as articulate as ever.
It sounds a bit like I feel when I wake up at 3:30 in the morning, to be honest. You got United this year, and I should say many congratulations. If I'd said 50 years ago, you'll still be playing with bits of plasticine and they'll call you Sir Peter as a reward, you wouldn't have believed it, would you?
Absolutely not. No, there were two of us, wasn't there? Me and my partner David, we were at school together. We were schoolboys, and we started out officially in 1976. And our only plan was to keep going, I would say. That was it. We'd be astonished, and in fact disbelieving, if anyone told us what the future held.
And you carry on, despite the fact there's all that technology that allows computers to generate cartoons for things to be done by CGI, you're still there with little men we feel we can, and little animals we can touch and feel. Is that one of the secrets of your success, do you think?
I think that's very good. I think you're quite right. I think the knowledge, the understanding of a viewer that these creatures that we've created are indeed just puppets brought to life. I think that's really important. You know, when you watch our films, that if you were at the studio, you could reach out and touch them. And all the stuff that's done on computers, which looks glorious and impressive, It doesn't have that. There's a sort of distance between it and the viewer, and I think that's what our work jumps that distance, I think.
And is it a reminder, in a sense, of the power that there was many decades ago in non-verbal comedy? It's not just the words, they're very funny, but there's a lot of facial expressions that make it a joy.
We do an awful lot, don't we, without words. Like, when you think about it, Morph, well, you've heard Morph speaking, not quite sure what he's saying. Shaun the Sheep doesn't speak, Gromit doesn't speak. So we have indeed built a career, a lot of it, on performance, visual performance, facial performance, that kind of stuff. And we have indeed looked at the classic, the Keatons and the Chaplins and people to see how it's done, to learn from them. That's important to us.
Now, you and I might not be still here in 50 years' time, but do you think those sorts of animations might still make it?
Yes, absolutely. I do. I think there's something honest about it, sort of irresistible, that people sense. They know that these creatures are real, and they know it, and they care that it's handmade. I think that's the most interesting part of it, that we make it clear that they're handmade. You know, when you see Shaun the Sheep, you can see the way their sets are built. You can see they're built of wood and plastic and metal, and beautifully painted, beautifully built, but real, tangible. And I think that will still be important, 50 years on.
Well, that is reassuring to hear. Sir Peter Lord, one of the founders of Aardman Animations, thank you very much indeed. And I know you've got a big exhibition coming on in what's called the Lightroom Exhibition in London indeed. In October. So fans will have a chance to relish their favourite creations.
Yeah. So few things that still bring undiluted joy, but Aardman still does. So thank you, Sir Peter, for that. We appreciate it. Just a couple of minutes to go in the programme this morning. It's been, I feel, Nick, quite fast moving in terms of where you are at the Reform Conference. I feel like what we started with at 6 and what we're ending with at 9. Just run us through what we've learned, what we've heard.
It has changed really every hour while we've been on air, Anna, as well as a dramatic change from last night to tonight, when Channel 4 News aired the undercover footage appearing to show Nigel Farage's aides trying to find a way to get round party funding rules to take money from an American but channel it through a British source. The initial reaction of the party was, it's all a hoax by our enemies, people who don't like us. Then they said there was an investigation. Then they said they'd done nothing wrong. Then they went on and said, well, even though they'd done nothing wrong, they were suspending the two people who apparently have done nothing wrong. And in the last few minutes, Nigel Farage has popped up and said, yes, the party, he says, has done nothing wrong, but the undercover reporting, in his words, doesn't look good. And he says that his aides have said things that shouldn't be said. And the sign of the confusion here, Anna, is that you may have heard Richard Tice say to me, we'll wait for the investigation the party does to see if these aides come back. And yet on another network, Lee Anderson, the party's chairman, says they're never coming back. The truth is, the people doing the rounds of the interviews, they don't know what the party's line is.
Yes, and the truth is also, and I say this to you as a veteran of party conference season, it doesn't matter who you are, what party you are, what you don't want to be happening is waking up on the morning of your leader's speech and instead to be dealing with something like this.
Absolutely, in large part because it's a distraction, and no doubt the people who chose to broadcast it last night knew the very date that they were targeting. But there's something more long-lasting than that, that matters more than that. Nigel Farage, after arguably becoming the most successful protest politician in post-war history, has been trying to say, look, I can take the next step. I can be your prime minister. In order to do that, he has to prove he's got policies, but above all, he has to prove that he's got competence, he's got judgment, he's got a team that you can trust. So to have yet another set of allegations now being investigated by the party, only potentially being investigated by the Metropolitan Police, they will tell us later on, no doubt, what their thoughts are, that raises questions about him and the people who surround him.
And those people who surround him, many of whom will be there where you are today, Nick, at the party conference, what about their thoughts on all of this, their feelings, their instinct as to who they support?
Well, the key issue here is the glass half full or is the glass half empty? On the one hand, despite all of this, they're somewhere they couldn't have